Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales.
Oh. Right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Monday morning. And that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We always like to start your work week off with a laugh. My dad calls in, tells a joke every Monday morning. Also, the Monday morning movie reviews coming up in just a couple of minutes. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress will join us to talk about all the new movies, and we'll talk about the box office as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. Good morning, everyone. Coming up a little bit later on, Ginger Baker passed away. One of the best drummers ever. So we're going to talk about great drummers, some of the greatest drummers of all time, and talk a little bit about Ginger Baker as well. Also, comedian Rip Taylor passed away. So we'll talk about Rip Taylor as well, one of my favorites. So funny. And more. We're also going to talk about pointless inventions and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and our Facebook page too. So there it is. Let's say good morning to my producer Tom. Tom Hush, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How are you?
I'm okay. You have a good weekend?
Yeah, great weekend. Very fun weekend.
Yeah. How about that SmackDown Friday?
Oh my God,
that was fun, huh?
Yeah. I don't think I've seen an opening like that for a SmackDown in years.
Well, it was crazy, and you know, it was just. I mean, they pulled out all the stops.
I think that might be the biggest stage they've ever had for SmackDown. They really built it out.
Yeah, they did. And they also had like the blue carpet beforehand and everything. Yeah, they you know, it's on Fox now, so, you know, and it's going to be live every week. That was fun though. It was fun to watch SmackDown. My parents and my mother really enjoyed Hell in a Cell. She watched it last night and was very happy with some of the outcome. They were telling me about it earlier. So Hell in the Cell is in the books now. So there it is. So I understand that you did go see Joker.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a movie.
Yeah.
It's definitely a guy who directed by a person.
Yeah.
And there's actors in it.
Yeah.
You can quote me on that.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it in a little bit with Eric and Steve. A lot of money over the weekend. $93 million,
as expected.
Yeah, really, no, I mean, that's about what we thought it was going to make.
Incredibly, you know, polarizing opinions too.
Yeah,
pretty much everybody I see either thinks it's a masterpiece or can't stand it.
Yeah,
so it's very interesting who it shakes out with. But I did notice that many of the people that I know who saw it and really loved it have never seen Taxi Driver.
Oh God!
So I was like,
yeah, you might want to
let me lend you this.
You might want to watch Taxi Driver. Because the Joker movie would not exist without Taxi Driver. There's no question about it. God, I love that movie. Taxi Driver is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's my favorite Scorsese movie. Yeah. Well, Joker is not Taxi Driver, I can tell you that.
No, it is not.
So, all right, in the newsroom, it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Doing very well. Nice weekend.
Yeah, you had a good weekend.
Yeah, I had a good packed weekend. Always feels nice when it's a busy one because I feel like I had a weekend, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Disappointed in the Bears.
I didn't get to see that game because I was in the far northwest suburbs watching my eighth grade son play football. Can I give an update?
Yeah, please.
They won, so the Wolves are undefeated, 5-0. They clinched a playoff spot, and their defense still has not allowed a single point. They're doing really well, man. And it's just it was so fun because my son finished with a sack, a forced fumble, and three tackles. So I was really proud of him.
Man,
did great, man.
I cannot believe that they still have not given up a point.
I couldn't either. They came close. They played Woodstock this weekend, so it was close. Woodstock almost scored a field goal, but it ended up shutting them out. So
That is unbelievable.
I said, is your coach talking to you about possibility that you could you know, possibly make it to the championship game and win it? That's all we talk about.
Yeah.
That's what he said. So.
Yeah. Well, that's something. That's
yeah,
really,
they're
that's,
focused that's for a really group of amazing. Young guys. Yeah,
that's
thanks.
Really amazing. Wow. Congratulations.
Thanks,
to those
sir.
Guys. That's fantastic.
I better call my bookie.
Right.
Better call your bookie. Yeah. Start placing your bets now.
All right.
Yeah.
The Wolves.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
The Wolves.
That's fantastic. So, all right. Well, yeah, man. Oh, it's getting a little chilly out there.
I love it. I'm very excited.
Yeah, me too. I know it's going to be like, it's going to get down to like 35 by the end of the week.
Oh, yeah.
So open up those windows.
Well, there's no better feeling than getting up. Like, I like to get up relatively early on the weekends, even though it's my time to catch up on sleep. I get up at about 7 o'clock in the morning and I just go outside and get my newspaper and I just like breathing in the kind of brisk air.
Yeah.
You're getting those smells of fall a little bit. The leaves are starting to turn on some trees. There's nothing better.
Yeah, no, it's my favorite. I mean, I you know, we very rarely have a proper autumn in this city because it usually goes from like 95 degrees to 10 below. So we usually don't get that fantastic, this kind of weather, you know, this kind of fall weather, which I really like. It's my favorite. It's my favorite time of year. So we should just revel in it right now, you know? So, yeah. It always scares me, and I kind of forget, but when I start hearing the clanging of my radiator, when that kicks in, that's when I know, it hasn't happened yet. I'm assuming by the end of the week, I'm probably going to get some clanging and some hissing, in the apartment, I would imagine by the end of the week, because we're going to get down to like 35 degrees. So I'm sure that that's when it's going to kick in. But that's always a fun thing. You get that first, like, you know, the smell of the radiator and the heat and stuff like that.
I do miss radiator heat, even though, you know, obviously central heat is great and it's modern convenience. It does remind me of when I was in college living in an apartment with radiator heat. There was something different about that heat.
Yeah.
Something, a different quality to it that just
I love radiator heat.
It's good.
Yeah, I do. I think it's fantastic.
You know, in my building, it was built in the 80s, this tower I live in, and it's obviously central, but something happens every year, and this time of year, they shut off the air conditioner, so you can't turn it on, which is fine when days are like this, 60s, but every now and then, we'll get hit with two or three days of 80s, and they won't turn it back on, so... Yeah. Hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll stay nice.
Yeah. No, this is good weather. I like this kind of weather. So, anyway. All right, well, we're enjoying the fall. We're all into it now. And the big fall movies are coming out. It's, you know, for the next couple of months, all the serious, like, you know, Oscar hopefuls and all those movies are coming out. And, you know, we'll keep an eye on all of them. Eric and Steve and myself covering them all. We got a lot to talk about this morning. In terms of movie reviews. So we're going to get to that. And again, our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we'll get to that. We're going to remember Ginger Baker as well and talk about some great drummers from the past. All that and more. If you want to join us again, it's 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page. And that's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll have the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Eric and Steve. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago here until 5 a.m. I am your overnight dude every weekday morning. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we do that every Monday morning. And Monday morning movie reviews coming up in just a couple of seconds here. We'll get that going with Steve and Eric. Also, we're going to be talking about Ginger Baker passed away. One of the best drummers ever in the history of music. He died at 80. He was with Cream and Blind Faith. And so we're going to talk about great drummers, and we're going to talk about Ginger Baker. Rip Taylor died. So we're going to talk about that and a lot more here on a Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, they join me every Monday morning to review the new movies, and we'll talk box office as well. So let's get the guys in here right now because it's that time of week. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Hi. How about that Rip Taylor, man?
Yeah.
I just, oh.
I'm more upset by Ginger Baker, to
well,
be honest.
Well, I mean, it's, they're both, I mean, I can understand. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
but
sure.
You know, Rip Taylor, man, you know, star of Jackass.
Star of so many confetti-themed things.
Obviously, Ginger Baker is, you know, one of the greatest drummers that's ever lived, and it's a massive loss. And but both those guys, man.
The documentary about Ginger Baker that came out a few years ago called Beware of Mr. Baker is one of the most amazing music documentaries I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And he just comes off as such a jerk, and yet you kind of still love him at the end.
Like, yeah.
He literally punches the director on camera. It's so beautiful. It's
fantastic. All right. Well, let's get to the movie reviews here. Let's see. Steve, why don't you tell us about The Parts You Lose?
Yes. So on the way home from school one afternoon, a 10-year-old North Dakota boy named Wesley, who's played by a newcomer named Danny Murphy, stumbles upon a man played by Aaron Paul, who plays a character that's never actually even given a name. He's passed out on the side of the road. He's bleeding. He's nearly frozen, clearly on the verge of dying. And Wesley pulls the man to an abandoned barn near his family's rather isolated property and brings him food and medical supplies and blankets and whatever else he needs to survive. And he continues to go to school every day, but in the meantime, he's sort of being bullied relentlessly. But in the meantime, he's sort of taking care of this person. And he also finds out there was some really terrible crime that had been committed in a nearby town that left a handful of people dead and a suspect in the wind who may be injured. So being a smart kid, Wesley just figures out that his new friend is this suspect, and he may not be the nicest guy. So, but weirdly, the two form a really interesting bond based on feeling like outsiders in a world at large, and they begin a sort of interesting partnership based on looking out for each other. Now, Wesley is actually deaf, as is the actor who plays him, and he communicates via sign language and teaches this Paul's character to do that. In return, Paul teaches Wesley how to stick up for himself, and even if that means getting a little violent with his bully. So some of the lessons aren't necessarily appropriate, but they're just instill enough confidence in the kid that they seem to do the trick. So Wesley's home life is not that great, especially for a boy with his condition. His mother is very protective. She's played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. She's an angel with Wesley and his sister, and she knows sign language, and clearly the three are very happy together. But unfortunately, Wesley has a father who's there sporadically, who's played by Scoot McNairy, who decides to come back while this is all happening, and he gets drunk a lot, and he's not a very happy person, and he kind of looks at his son, as he puts it, as a busted TV that you can just smack around a few times to get it working again. So the man in the barn is recuperating. The cops show up. The U.S. Marshals show up. Wesley doesn't give him up, but at the same time, the cops aren't stupid in this story, so and they're pretty relentless. The part you lose is actually the directing debut of Christopher Cantwell, who's the creator of one of my absolute favorite series in recent memories called Halt and Catch Fire, that was on AMC. McNary was in that show, and it felt more like a really long movie than a TV series. But really, the bulk of the film is just watching Aaron Paul and this kid together playing checkers or teaching each other things. Paul teaches the kid how to fill up his thermos with coins and use them as a weapon if he needs to. It's fascinating, a tiny bit uncomfortable, since we're always sort of afraid that Paul's paranoia is going to get the best of him and maybe the kid will get hurt. The film's a little bit slow, but there are periods, and there are certainly periods where the drunk dad character feels more like a cliche domestic villain than an actual character. But I gotta say, like, there's a moment where Aaron Paul decides to teach the father a lesson about hitting his kid, and even though it leaves him slightly exposed because he comes out of the barn, he thinks it's worth it. Overall, though, the film is a great example of a beautifully crafted, photographed, low-key thriller that doubles as a terrific character study about marginalized people, and Aaron Paul admirers consider this sort of a worthy placeholder until his Breaking Bad movie comes out pretty soon on Netflix. This one is definitely worth seeking out, and you can see it through the week at Facets.
All right, there you go. So that's The Part You Lose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. All right, Eric, tell us about First Love.
Okay, I'll try. This is the latest film from director Takashi Miike, and it's one of these sort of sprawling, violent crime comedies that you kind of need like a notebook to kind of keep track of everything that's going on in it. Revolves around two sort of outsider characters who basically become sort of the center, at least the sympathetic centers of this movie. One is a boxer, and another is a drug addicted kind of crime boss Maul, who is just not exactly at the top of her game. She has hallucinations of her dead father, and just kind of stuck in this world. And it's going to get shaken up a bit by a crooked cop and one of the members, I believe, one of the members of the crime syndicate. They basically form this plan where the man on the inside will rob the crime syndicate and then will be subsequently arrested by the crooked cop and put away for a couple of years until basically the triad and the syndicate basically just kind of collapse and destroy each other, and then he'll get out and they'll be able to split the money that they've hidden together. Well, things don't exactly go as planned, because these are kind of a group of bumbling guys, results in a lot of violence, a lot of screaming, a lot of people being shot, and things being severed and shoved out of windows, but with a wink in its eye towards everything. Sort of the best way to sort of describe this movie is, A True Romance seems to be a very easy way to parallel this film. And Takashi Miike is a director that has certainly made a few really great movies, Audition being one of them. I'm a big fan of 13 Assassins as well. He's a guy that makes a lot of movies, and when you make a lot of movies, a good portion of them will not exactly aspire to everyone's taste, and I've never been entirely on board with the majority of his films, and I'm sorry to say that this falls into that category as well. Having seen a number of these movies done with the same kind of manic style and over-the-top violence, it almost seems to be like one of these Guy Ritchie Tarantino knockoffs that we got in the wake of Pulp Fiction, and True Romance for that matter. And, every once in a while something will click, something amusing happens, a bit of violence that you've maybe quite not seen done in a certain way kind of rings true. But ultimately, to me, it was just a lot of yelling, a lot of screaming, gunshots that basically wake you up from time to time. And didn't really care too much about the two wannabe lovers at the center of this thing. Some of the characters just not that interesting. You don't really care who makes it in and out of this story. And, I just kind of shrugged my shoulders at the end. I'm like, oh, that happened.
Okay. All right. Guys, hang on, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, there you go. Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got more of the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio in downtown Chicago here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to remember Ginger Baker and talk about some of the greatest drummers of all time and much more. Pointless inventions, too, is something we're going to talk about. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you'd like to join us. It is time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. That's what we're doing right now. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday to review the movies. Let's get Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Steve, tell us about Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool.
Yeah, I always look forward to the documentaries made by the director Stanley Nelson. He's a filmmaker that seems to have taken it upon himself to tell some really fascinating and necessary stories about Black Americans in all of his works, including there was one recently called Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of Black colleges and universities. And he had a really great one recently called about the Black Panthers. His latest endeavor is sort of a rarity for him in that it focuses just on one person and not an organization or movement. But of course, when that individual is Miles Davis, it is a bit like explaining a movement that sort of changed all music. I've actually been a really big fan of listening to Vic's Picks for the last few months.
Yeah.
And I think at some point, I know that on the list that Kind of Blue is on the list, I don't know how much he actually talked about it, but that's certainly focused on in this film. So in Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, Nelson has the unenviable task of detailing the creative genius and innovator through a fog of personal demons and just general bad behavior, especially toward the women in his life. But the resulting film is visually captivating. He lets the story sort of be told from the beginning and lets Miles Davis, often through words that are in his autobiography that are read by an actor named Carl Lumley, lets him tell his own story, and with a few supplemental interviews here and there by those that knew him best. There's some great archival footage and photos and especially recordings. The film tracks the musical evolution that is like very few other musicians, especially jazz musicians, ever went through, if for no other reason than Miles Davis actually managed to stay alive long enough to evolve. Davis was always on the lookout for sort of racism and other forms of being treated like anything other than a master artist. And when he was given free rein to go in the musical directions he wanted to, the journey was often sort of uncanny and resulted in albums that are considered touchstones of jazz. But as he got older, he got more experimental, gave over a lot of control to the musicians that he hand-selected for his band, let them just sort of go. rather than him guiding them as much. And the results in those cases sort of divided the jazz community in a lot of ways, but were a symphony of sound and sort of rarefied fusion rhythms and that defined and redefined the genre. You know, he played with Prince a couple times, both on stage and in the studio. He recorded a fairly straightforward some fairly straightforward pop song covers in his later years, and I can't think of anything more radical than that for him. Some of the most revealing and quite heartbreaking interviews in the film are with the most important women in his life who are still alive, or up until recently they were, including the famed dancer Frances Taylor, who ended up being his first wife. I think she just passed away 1 or 2 years ago. And then a French singer named Juliette Greco, both of whom give a lot of insight into Davis's process and temperament, especially when he let substance abuse creep into his life, which he did on a few occasions over the decades. But as the film's title suggests, one of Davis's big contributions to the world was redefining what it meant to be cool. And he did it with music and style and persona. The raspy voice certainly didn't hurt. And I'm sure a 4 or 6 hour version of this documentary could have been produced with very little trouble or shortage of material, but this is going to be something that's going to be on American Masters, I believe they said sometime next year. And it's as for a 2 hour film, it's exceptional in the ground that it covers. It gives the music the center stage as it should. And, it'll be playing for a couple weeks at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
All right, there it is. So that's Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. Okay. Eric, why don't you tell us about The Laundromat?
Okay. This one I saw at the Toronto Film Festival. I don't remember if we talked about this one or not.
I think you did.
Yeah,
I think you did.
We did.
Okay. I'll briefly recap. It's the latest film from Steven Soderbergh and screenwriter Scott Z. Burns. They've worked on many films together, a lot of great films, including The Informant and Side Effects and Contagion. And this latest one deals with their sort of take on the Panama Papers, which is... was a story that never quite got as much traction as it probably should have in the mainstream news. Basically, a discovery of how a lot of the people in the 1% were creating these bogus shell companies overseas, creating these phony companies that basically would screw over a lot of people on the mainland while sort of keeping their riches intact. And this movie plays basically almost like a series of vignettes and how that is possible. The film is narrated, sort of a fourth wall breaking narration by Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas, who play two guys, who I believe are playing two of the real guys, mm-hmm. Who are a part of this entire endeavor. They sort of are narrating the film and telling us exactly how everything is done, how they get away with it so easily, and basically telling us that there's nothing that we, the viewer, can do about it. So we follow a number of different people along this path, most notably at the beginning, Meryl Streep, who plays a woman who... very much is trying to enjoy her twilight years, then takes a boat trip with her husband. Things end up going bad. Her husband dies, and the people responsible for the tour company that they were part of end up getting screwed out of their insurance because of the scam created by these shell companies. Then we meet other people along the way, rich people hiding their wealth, getting involved with shady people that things might not turn out well for them, on top of everything that's happening to the rest of the 99%. Jeffrey Wright plays sort of a lawyer and a con artist who is helping to move the money around and keep the paperwork out of the wrong hands. So this movie, I just talked about a movie that kind of replicated the Tarantino-like flavor of the mid-90s, and here we have a film that weirdly enough, almost trying to emulate Adam McKay's The Big Short, and even Vice a little bit, and trying to explain this complicated tale that the sort of Joe Schmo might not know the ins and outs of, and not even realize just how badly we're being screwed by the rich. And it never quite gets around to having a real sort of a great encapsulation of everything that's going on. I mean, the movie is only about 90 minutes long. There's so much information that it wants to get out. Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas narrate this film to us in the I think the thickest versions of their accents possible, I think is part of the point from Soderbergh, to basically, we're trying to listen to what these guys are saying, but you kind of have to lean in to listen, and we're still not grasping everything that's going on. And I think that the vignette thing, it sounds good in theory, but ultimately never really gives us any kind of, even as an amalgam, character to sort of kind of grasp onto and watch us, guide us through this monstrosity of a thing that's happening. At least in The Big Short, which was certainly an ensemble piece, all these characters were fitting together to tell us another piece of the puzzle, and we're told, and we're done in such a way, and then, McKay did some fourth wall breaking himself when he needed to, that, that film seems very tight and, well structured, movie that I like very much, compared to this one, which just seems to be just hoping we get the gist of everything that's going on, but keeps bouncing us into these different stories that we sort of care less and less about the longer it goes on. I wish we had more time with the Meryl Streep aspect of the story, because at least it seems there was a sympathetic lead that we could follow. The other characters, not so much. We just keep wanting to getting back to where the story begins. And then ultimately where it ends, everything just kind of rings kind of hollow. And again, maybe that's kind of their point, but considering the work that these two guys have done together and what Scott C. Burns does on another film coming out later this year called The Report, which is incredibly intricate, about the torture report that was kind of buried in Congress for many years, this one just seems like a real kind of rare misfire on the part of a really great resume.
Okay. Hang on, guys, okay?
Yes.
All right, we're going to find out what Steve thought of The Laundromat as well, but we're going to do that after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio is here, and it is Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and we're going to talk about some pointless inventions, some of the greatest drummers of all time. Ginger Baker passed away, and Rip Taylor also passed away over the weekend, so we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And if you want to get in here, it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every week to talk about the movies. Let's bring Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, what did you think of The Laundromat?
Oh, 100% agree with not just Eric's overall assessment, but it's some of the individual things as well. One of the things, like I love Steven Soderbergh, almost every single thing he does. So one of the things he does so well is he makes even the driest material seem remarkably entertaining. And you don't have to look any further than earlier this year. The movie he made for Netflix, High Flying Bird, is a great one of the best movies of the year. it should not be as interesting as it is, but it is really fascinating. So it struck me as so strange that his choice here is to sort of spoon feed us this information like we're children. And I think it's a real detriment to the film. It doesn't really make the points any clearer. It just feels like pandering. And it's a, like Eric said, it's a rare misfire for him. And as undeniably charming as these two guys are who are narrating us through this complicated legal and banking maneuvers, it just as a storytelling device, it just feels really condescending. I also agree that, I thought the Meryl Streep sort of this desperate performance hits the closest to home, and like anyone that's ever had to deal with an insurance company or a financial institution can certainly identify with her pain. But she is determined to understand this maze of ownership that is this insurance company that she's trying to deal with initially, and it leads her down this path of discovering bribery and tax evasion and a host of additional sort of corrupt business and politicians that are meant to overwhelm her and hopefully discourage her from digging too deep, but that's not her. And I like that aspect of it. I actually really, really there are a whole host of famous faces in this in very small parts, but the one that just kept cracking me up was Jeffrey Wright's character, who it's almost too complicated to understand what his relationship is to these two guys, but he basically just is in charge of a lot of shell companies. He made me laugh so much because his entire job seems to be avoiding phone calls and just people in general. And it's particularly funny when you see how he's sort of taken down near the end. The film isn't a complete failure. It's certainly watchable. I don't think it's as instructional or as interesting as Soderbergh might think it is. There's definitely something lacking, especially when you consider the filmmaker and how much better and smarter he usually is. So, and the film also will hit Netflix in a couple of weeks.
Okay. All right. So that's The Laundromat. All right. Steve, why don't you tell us about Lucy and This Guy?
Yes. Okay. So this is sort of loosely inspired by the 2007 events when astronaut Lisa Nowak drove nearly 1,000 miles to attack a rival for another astronaut's affection. Lucy in the Sky attempts to sort of dive into the mindset of an astronaut who has trouble adjusting to her earthbound life after joining this elite group of men and women who have been to space and seen just how small and fragile the planet can be. Natalie Portman plays Lucy Kola, a Texas-born astronaut who has spent a lifetime just being the best at everything. She's a strong and worthy role model for her niece that now lives with her because her brother is a flake, and she's a loyal wife to a guy played by Dan Stevens, who's sort of a lovable nerd that works in NASA's PR office. But after her short but deeply impactful time in space, she returns only to find that the world around her feels very small and insignificant. She has trouble roaming among civilians who have no idea what she's accomplished or experienced, and so she turns naturally to those around her, other astronauts, who have or will experience what she has. And as she prepares for a much longer and more challenging upcoming mission, she starts spending a lot of time with a more senior astronaut played by John Hamm and a few of his colleagues. But eventually Lucy and Hamm's character begin an affair that seems to sort of trigger an emotional time bomb in her. It doesn't help that Lucy's husband is sort of pressuring her not to go back to space. And she has this relentless mother who's played by Ellen Burstyn, who visits frequently and is the source of all the self-doubt in her life that still exists. And then there's an adversary for Mark's affections who comes into the picture in the form of a newer NASA cadet played by Zazie Beetz, who has a busy week. And although the two women sort of start out as friends, it becomes clear that that John Hamm's character is something of a ladies' man, and Lucy begins to unravel and make demands on him that are very unreasonable, especially considering she's still very married. To say that Lucy's world begins to unravel would be sort of an understatement, but that's effectively what happens. And one would think that the director, Noah Hawley, who is the showrunner of such series as Fargo and Legion, would be sort of the perfect fit for a story about a fluid reality. But something about Lucy in the Sky feels very empty and off the mark. Portman's performance is really solid, and that carries this film a great deal. But it seems like a strange story to tell in a fictionalized form, because it's almost as if the film is attempting to say women can't handle the pressures of being an astronaut or the stress of returning from space. And if you tell the story of the actual Lisa Nowak and attempt to explain her behavior, at least you can point to the actual events and say, well, that's what happened. But here, since it's a different version of the story, it feels representative and sort of cheapens the impact of the whole movie. That being said, I like the way Holly constantly, he repositions the frame's aspect ratio throughout the film to make us sort of feel that, like, reality isn't stable, and perhaps even giving us a glimpse into Lucy's state of mind. It's a great device for giving us a psychological profile, but so I like the way the story illustrates Lucy's determination. There's a great scene in which she almost drowns in a training exercise rather than leave a task incomplete. Of course, if she'd been to space, she would have died, but that doesn't really matter to her. She doesn't always consider the consequences. We don't really get to know Lucy before her journey, so we don't really see how much she has changed. In a strange way, Portman's strong performance is also part of the problem. She sort of stands out in surroundings that don't rise to her level. And as a result, Lucy in the Sky is mostly a disappointment, because you can sense that this is a story worth exploring, but they don't really explore it in a way that I think is particularly meaningful.
Okay. Guys, hang on. I'll tell you what I thought of it after we break here. Hold on, guys. Mm-hmm. All right. Eric and Steve are here. And when we get back, I'll tell you what I thought of Lucy in the Sky right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and much more. So let's get back to the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric and Steve are with me. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, before the break, Steve was telling us what he thought of Lucy in the Sky. And I pretty much agree with everything you said there, Steve. I was really disappointed by this movie because I was really, really looking forward to it. It's very muddled. I wasn't really sure what the movie was really about. It seems like a very mixed up film. Portman's really good in it, though. It's a really solid performance, but it's not really grounded in anything. And it really does get confusing. And overall, I just didn't really. Ultimately, I just didn't really care what was happening. Despite the fact that I think Portman really is, she's all in. You know what I mean? Like it's a very good performance. But I just did, like the Ellen Burstyn character. I didn't understand what was going on there, and I wasn't sure. It's based on that really weird incident from like 10 years ago or whenever. You said 2007, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember that story just being so strange. But I really don't see that this is a taking off point for that. It doesn't make any sense. So it's a muddled movie. I think Portman tries the best she can. But it never comes together. I wasn't quite sure what the message was of the movie, and I just felt that it was really just sort of bogged down, and I just didn't care. And it's again, you know, we were going to talk about Zazie Beetz in another movie this week. I love that woman, and I wish I wish she would, you know, like be used more, you know, used better in movies, because she's not the two movies that we're talking about this week that feature her are kind of, to me, a waste of time for her.
Well, the thing is, like, I don't think she's being used. She's picking these roles.
Yeah, no,
so,
it's
like,
true.
I mean, granted, she's new at this, and she's kind of just happy to be in anything, probably, at this point. But I don't think there are bigger versions of these roles somewhere on the cutting room floor. I think this is what she signed up for.
Yeah.
And, but you're right. She's basically just the woman in both of these movies.
Both of the movies. Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, and this is someone who just, like, kills on Atlanta.
Yeah,
and she's so great, and I really like. And I thought she was really fun in the Deadpool movies, and I really like her, and I just want to see I want to see more of her. So this is a really muddled movie. It didn't work for me at all, and I can't recommend it. So that's Lucy in the Sky. All right, Eric, tell us about Memory: The Origins of Alien.
Okay, this one I do remember talking to you about from Sundance. Played opening night, one of the opening night movies, and it's a documentary about the making of Ridley Scott's seminal 1979 classic Alien. Memory, the title refers to the draft that Dan O'Bannon was working on, never quite completed, but ultimately would turn into what Alien became. And that's sort of where this movie, does a jumping off point, is really kind of taking us into what seems for a little while is going to be a documentary about Dan O'Bannon, which is, you know, something that we haven't really gotten before. And that's full of a lot of very interesting details. You know, there's a lot in this movie. Anyone who's followed Alien for the past 40 years, and all of its incarnations, knows a great bit, a great deal of the material that's in this movie. The film was, created by, director Alexandria Ofelipe, who's done some really terrific documentaries, including the People versus George Lucas, which is a lot of fun, and the 78-52, which is about the creation of the shower scene from Psycho. And I think that is when this movie is sort of at its best, is sort of later in the proceedings, when it sort of gets down to what he was doing with 78-52 and basically breaking down the scene that the film is basically known for, which is the chestburster sequence, showing us all the different angles and, you know, what went into putting that thing together and why it was shot in certain ways and why certain moments of the film have characters framed a certain way. Where I think this film fails on a couple parts that really kind of bogged it down for me. One, the talking heads that they have, the sort of the experts and the critics and the historians that they have talking about this film, really kind of, you know, up their own heads, basically, talking about this movie, you know, delving into information and tidbits about the film as if they discovered them themselves, as if, like, most of the people who are probably watching this film, big fans of Alien, as all of us are, don't really know this information. If I remember correctly, there's a moment even where Ben Mankiewicz even kind of screws up the resume of Walter Hill, at least his timeline, that really just kind of annoyed me. But also, you know, if you're doing, a movie about Alien, and while you are going to do a little bit of commentary on what a transformative film this was in regards to female empowerment in movie, which this movie does get around to talking about, if you don't have Sigourney Weaver on board to be one of your talking heads, you almost may as well shut the film down. Because, well, you know, this film does have Tom Skerritt and Veronica Cartwright talking about stuff. Not having Sigourney there just seems like, it's not a missed opportunity, it just seems like an absolute failure. It's just like, you know, why you wouldn't want to start there, and, you know, I suppose you work with what you got, but they almost seem to bypass Ripley a bit too much, just because they don't have her. So they focus on other things, and while some of that stuff is very interesting, a lot of it is stuff that's been covered before. There's a major documentary on one of the Alien DVD Blu-ray sets that came out many years ago, a three-hour one, if I recall correctly, and that one has as much information as you're going to find in this one, with the exception of those couple sequences that I referred to. So ultimately, I kind of found the film kind of a mixed bag. I definitely wanted a lot more talk about Sigourney and Ripley. The talking heads bothered me, but there is some fascinating stuff in the movie. So I wouldn't not recommend the film, but I don't think that it's essential viewing either for people that are really down with Alien over the last 40 years.
Okay. All right, what'd you think, Steve?
I loved it, and I will say, I think it's the subtitle of the film that's the most important thing for people to understand, the origins of Alien, and the Ripley thing is probably secondary, because if I'm not mistaken, that Ripley wasn't even conceived as a female character at first, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so, I mean, this was never a movie that was going to be about female empowerment. That's what it became. That's certainly one of the impacts of the film, but this is a film that's dealing more with what went into that initial concept, and visually and story-wise. I think one of our colleagues said this is not a making-of film, it's a thinking-of film. And Eric's right, that documentary on the Alien Blu-ray is one of the best making-of things I've ever seen. This film is more of a step-by-step through the things that... everything from like the things that influenced the story, like Egyptian mythology and Lovecraft, and even parasitic wasps and certain comic book stories, and the Francis Bacon's paintings. Like I've never seen any of those things really talked about that much. Of course, any of the actors in this would have been crucial. And in fact, the film was conceived initially as a movie that's just about the chestburster sequence, which is why there is that element in here. And almost that stuff almost seems out of place, but it's so good, who cares? At its core, yeah, Eric mentioned it's a love letter to Dan O'Bannon. And then we get into the Giger stuff and the sort of highly stylized, sexually symbolic nightmare fuel that we've loved for the last 40 years. I also love the discussion of why Alien was such a hit in 1979, but then like 3 years later, everyone went like cute and cuddly E.T. as opposed to The Thing, for our next big Alien hit. That's a fascinating conversation. There's sort of a wealth of never before seen archival stuff and storyboards and notes from all the creative partners. It feels more like it's a film essay. It feels like a master's thesis almost on this film, more than just like a traditional making of. And I love Philippe, the director, for making films like that, because they feel like they're made for us. And he's already got another film that's on the festival circuit right now called Leap of Faith, which is all about William Friedkin and The Exorcist. So hopefully we'll be seeing that pretty soon. And it's just like a sit-down interview with Friedkin, basically, walking through that. So I think film buffs are going to eat this up. It might almost be too much detail and background for regular people, but yeah, fans of this film and just like filmmaking in general, I think you're going to love it.
Okay. Hang on, guys.
Yeah.
All right. Eric and Steve are going to hang on. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Memory, The Origins of Alien, right after this on 720 WGN.
Silent movie, evening, shooting.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time on a Monday morning. We're going to talk about Ginger Baker, who passed away. We're going to talk about some of his great work and some of the greatest drummers of all time. We're also going to talk about pointless inventions and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning movie reviews are continuing. Let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
So, Memory, the origins of Alien. I really liked it. I thought it was. There was a lot of stuff in there that I didn't know about. And I think, Steve, what you're saying about if you're really a big fan of the of this film, you're gonna really eat this up. There's a lot of stuff in here. I was really amazed at how much the movie is dedicated to O'Bannon. I mean, it was, you know. He gets mentioned all the time, in connection with Alien, of course, as he should. But this seemed like a real, like, it seemed to me like this was a movie that was like, that wanted to sort of rectify how much Dan O'Bannon is responsible for the, for uh-huh. Alien. And I think it's like sort of like this justified thing. Like after all these years, finally Dan O'Bannon, even though he's passed away, is finally getting sort of, you know, the credit he deserves for just how much Alien is his baby.
Mm-hmm.
I could have done with a little bit more Walter Hill, because we could all use a little more Walter Hill in our lives. But I thought they did a really fantastic, you know, it's a pretty fascinating movie, and I was pretty compelled by the whole thing. It also helps that, you know, because, you know, Alien is a great film. And it also just got me to thinking that Ridley Scott's only made like a couple of good movies.
Very true.
I mean, seriously. I mean, I just, like, when it was over, I was like, man, you know, I mean, the Blade Runner and Alien are like two of the greatest science fiction movies ever made. And then that's about it. When I was just thinking back to the career of Ridley Scott, and you're a fan, Steve. You a big fan of Ridley Scott?
He is definitely hit and miss.
Yeah,
but I think he has more hits than two. So.
Well,
I don't know. I'm closer to you, Nick.
I don't know.
Shocking.
Stop it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I like Thelma and Louise.
Yeah, Black Hawk Down.
Yeah,
Gladiator. Yeah.
Keep going.
Oh, I'm not a fan of Gladiator. Not a fan of Gladiator at all.
Yeah, we're in the 3-star territory now.
Yeah. So, but anyway, but this documentary itself is great. If you're a fan of Alien, as so many people are, this is a fascinating movie. It's beautifully it's beautifully put together, and I was compelled by the entire thing. And you know, as someone who has seen Alien 9,000 times, it's nice to have a fresh perspective on it. And and I thought it was terrific. I think it's really, really terrific. And I saw it on the VOD. That's where you can check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's available on video on demand.
Also playing at the ArcLight, by the way.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay. It's at the ArcLight.
It's kind of snuck in there on Friday, but yeah, it's
okay.
In there.
All right, cool. There it is. So check it out. All right, Steve.
Uh-oh.
Tell us about Joker.
Well, it was nice knowing you guys.
We'll be over here, Steve. Go ahead.
No, I this might be my last show, actually. No. Well, I mean, look, at this point, let me start with some simpler things. Like, at this point, it feels like just about any actor who wants to play Joker, arguably the most famous comic book villain in history, can take a crack at him. At some point, I think in the not-too-distant future, it's going to be as common to play Joker as for an actor to dive into Hamlet or Jesus or, let's be honest, even Batman. But the results so far have been sort of an array of portrayals that have run the spectrum from cartoonish to sort of anarchic linchpin. I mean, I don't think it's possible for me to even consider any portrayal of Joker more devastating than what Heath Ledger did in The Dark Knight, although the kid Cameron Monaghan, who just played him on the Gotham series, is really remarkable. I've seen a few people put him up there pretty high, too.
Worth, I would agree with that. Definitely.
What's that?
He's worth mentioning, definitely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think he's terrific. And I think, honestly, I think Gotham was a better origin story for the character,
yes,
too.
Yes, it was.
So this more humanized version that Joaquin Phoenix gives us in Joker is extraordinary for different reasons. But I want to say this off the top. Joker is not the type of film that is inherently dangerous. I can't believe I have to say that, but I feel like I do. It absolutely does not glorify or excuse terrible behavior. It does, and I said this about the Roy Cohen film last week too, although obviously that's a real person, but I said what it does remind us of is that monsters are not born, they are made. The screenwriters Todd Phillips and Scott Silver give us their version of Joker in the form of Arthur Fleck, who is a depressive oddball from way back, and through the course of his life we discover that he was abused as a child and in different ways abused as an adult by the world around him. The film, again, isn't giving Arthur's terrible behavior a pass or an excuse, but at the same time, it's important to know the elements that blended him to make this sort of perfect storm of evil. Arthur seems harmless enough in the beginning. The film is set in the 1980s, and Joker gives us a portrait of an underweight party clown who, with a slightly dated wardrobe and a healthy pallor and an affliction that makes him burst out laughing at the most inappropriate moments. It sounds kind of funny, but he laughs so hard at times he almost chokes or throws up. It's meant to seem painful to Arthur, and he clearly isn't happy even when he's giggling maniacally, at least at first. He takes care of his elderly mother, played by Frances Conroy, she is obsessed with writing letters to the richest guy in town, Thomas Wayne, who's played by Brett Cullen. She used to work for him decades earlier and believes he will help her and her son if only he sort of is made aware of the squalor they are living in Gotham City presently. Arthur suffers sort of one indignity after another. He's beaten up on the job. He's berated by his boss. He finds solace in a few places, including therapy, and he seems to possess the knowledge that he is barely holding back something terrible. But with therapy and medication, it's sort of being kept in check. But it's clearly something in his personality he does not want to confront. He befriends a young single mom that lives down the hall. This is Zazie Beetz's character we talked about before. And they kind of hit it off, but even that's sort of suspect. He has a passion for being a stand-up comic, and although we only see a bit of his sort of overly rehearsed routine, we can tell that's not going to go well for him. He's also obsessed with a TV talk show host who's played by Robert De Niro and has fantasies about his comedy career leading to a guest spot on the show. Another sad delusion that you could sort of add to the list.
Okay, hang on, Steve.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, we got to take a break here. Hang on, Steve and Eric. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about Joker, and we'll do the box office as well right here on 720 WGN, and we'll be back after this. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And also it's the Monday morning movie reviews. That's what we're in the middle of right now. Before the break, Steve was telling us a little bit about Joker. Eric, welcome back.
No, thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, continue. Joker.
So this is, even if you ultimately loathe Joker, it's kind of difficult for me to believe that you will not find some value in this film, whether it's Phoenix's unnerving performance or the way that the filmmaker and his team sort of capture the very gritty quality of Gotham City on the brink of collapse. I've never seen a Gotham portrayed this realistically, and there's crime and there's garbage strikes and there's something called super rats that I think are awesome and so on. So I like this take just because, if only because it's different and not so art directed. Then there's this sort of escalation of Phoenix's mood, of Arthur's mood. He ends up making a very terrible choice when he's harassed by these three guys, these sort of Wall Street guys or whatever Gotham's equivalent to Wall Street is. And what he does changes everything. And the citizens of Gotham, who aren't millionaires, sort of take notice. And what's worse, they seem to be inspired by it. And the common people's attitude toward the rich gets really ugly at a certain point. My biggest issues with the film have nothing really to do with its messages or the impact the film may have on the world at large. Without giving anything away, I was really disappointed with the last third of the film. Arthur is making this final transformation into this true villain. There's a scene, this is in the trailer, so I don't think I'm giving anything away. There's a scene where he actually makes it on Murray's talk show. And I think from that moment on, I lost total interest in the film because it seemed like it was overstating every message that had been fairly subtle up to that point. The story, you know, as he begins to sort of formulate this idea that bringing joy into the world is his purpose on life, or I should say, as that sort of dissipates and he becomes something much more evil, I just lost interest in the film, and it seems more about it turns into the spectacle and there's a big splashy ending than any kind of morality lesson. It's less a cautionary tale than a traditional origin story. The movie doesn't make excuses. It lays out this life in decline and dares us to watch how it turns out. That might be too much for some people. I've actually been shocked at some of the people saying it made them uncomfortable. It didn't make me uncomfortable. At least the subject matter didn't. It's a sleazy, feel-bad character study, and I like those aspects of Joker much more than I kind of dug the messages that were kind of buried in. There were moments where they could have made real statements about health care to mentally ill people and things like that, and that's kind of pushed to the side. So anyway, yeah, it has moments for me, but I can't fully recommend it either.
Okay. All right, Eric, go ahead.
Okay. Not to do any kind of direct commentary on what Steve has said, because there are extreme takes on this movie from all sides. The only bit of it that I would take issue with is that I think that this film, while I will not go down the road and say, you know, the film is dangerous and would cause violence, because that would be very hypocritical of me. But the fact is that I think this movie does provide excuses for the Joker's behavior, starting with the mental illness aspect. Giving him, this laughing fit that he has a card that he has to hand around to people to explain his issue, then leads into, the bullying and the crazy mother, and there's got a history of mental illness, being cast, possibly potentially cast out of a better life by someone who is, in all of the Batman stories we've ever known, is a award-winning philanthropist, and here is just kind of reduced to basically being a jerky politician. So that's all I'll say about that aspect of it. But needless to say that, trying to sort of encapsulate so much that I have that I've thought about and had to say about this movie, just thinking about the best way to sort of encapsulate this is in regards to the person who made it, which is Todd Phillips. Not even discounting what the stuff that he's been saying in the press and that kind of stuff, because that's all an afterthought compared to my experience watching the movie. But I think of the exchange in A Fish Called Wanda, where Kevin Kline says, "Apes don't read philosophy," and Jamie Lee Curtis says, "Yes, they do, Otto. They just don't understand it." And that's exactly what I feel about Todd Phillips. It seems like he watched a few Scorsese movies late one night on cable. He's seen some of the Batman movies, notably Batman Returns, maybe Dark Knight, a bit of Dark Knight Rises, which also deals with the divide between the haves and the have-nots, and is a guy that doesn't quite understand what those films were bringing to those essential storylines. People like to bring up, Fight Club is another way of the sort of the toxic masculinity that, we hear so much about in society. And the fact that Todd Phillips is not aware of why people are asking these questions about has he made a film that might be considered dangerous, and that he doesn't even understand that, shows me that he doesn't quite understand the film that he made. There are so many things about this movie that bother me, from the handling of reducing this, this iconic villain that is up there, in the echelons of the basically the great evil characters. And anytime you see a character like, whether it be, forgive me, Nick, Hannibal Lecter or Michael Myers or Leatherface reduced, or Norman Bates for that example, reduced to an origin story, when the scariest thing about those characters is we don't know exactly why they're evil, they just are, really kind of, put the damper on who this character is. And yes, there have been all kinds of interpretations. One of the beauties about that character is one of the things that I think Christopher Nolan captured so beautifully with The Dark Knight, in that he kept telling a different origin story about himself and how he got the scars on his face. And that's something that has been prevalent in the comics. And yes, comics, there are different versions of the comics and things like that. That's all great. There's a valid, there are valid excuses of why this movie could and even should exist. But it's in the hands of a filmmaker who doesn't have any grasp of the material, very little grasp on the character. And most importantly, I think, when sort of comparing this movie, these things we've been hearing about why people think that, this might make people uncomfortable, is that this movie doesn't have a Batman. And I don't just mean that in the context of an actual guy around wearing a mask. I mean it in the metaphorical sense, that there is no light to the darkness here. This is like watching Christine and watching that entire movie, and you're kind of with Arnie while the car and him are dispatching the bullies throughout the movie, and you're kind of like, maybe this is wrong morally, but they kind of deserve it. But there's not a point in, if there wasn't a point in Christine where you go, oh, wait, Arnie is going completely off the rails, and he has to be stopped. This movie doesn't have that moment. And Phillips is such a poor filmmaker that he's never quite certain of when the audience is supposed to be within Arthur Fleck's point of view or within our perception of his point of view. And that's handled with one major minor character in the film that is, he kind of tries to pull a rug and pull on us that is really poorly handled, and then it's never quite clear if what we're experiencing at other parts of the movie are through his eyes or through our perception of it. Is Thomas Wayne really that jerky, or is this how we're seeing Arthur perceive him? Todd Phillips is not the person to be making this movie. He is a bad, awful filmmaker. And if you want to say that I have a bias towards Todd Phillips, well, you hand me 10 rotten apples in a row, I'm going to be skeptical about the 11th. I went in with a morbid sense of curiosity to this movie, and I walked out having watched one of the worst films of the year.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, and we'll come back, and I'll tell you what I thought of Joker after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 5. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are going to talk about some pointless inventions and some of the greatest drummers of all time because Ginger Baker passed away, who was one of the best drummers that ever lived. So we're going to get into that. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Before the break, Eric and Steve told us what they thought of Joker. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, I hated it. I hated every frame of it. I think it's perhaps the worst movie I've seen all year. And I agree with everything, Eric. I'm totally on your side on this one. It's derivative of so many other movies that are so much better. And Todd Phillips is a terrible filmmaker. It's not for listen. Joaquin is he's on board here. You know, I mean, he's 100% in. There's no. I mean, you could tell that this is a performance that it's kind of exhausting to watch. You know what I mean? It is one of those like really intense performances that you can tell that he's really really working hard. And you know, I mean, that's Joaquin. He does. That's what he does. You know. But everything about this movie is unlikable. I just didn't like it. I didn't like anything about it. It was just an unpleasant experience for 2 solid hours. I didn't care about anything that was happening. In fact, I disliked everybody in the movie. I don't know if De Niro's ever been lazier in a movie, and that's saying a lot.
He's more comfortable on SNL, Nick.
Yeah, well, that's what it feels like that, you know. So I don't know why this movie even exists. I don't know why we have to have 27 different versions of this character. I don't understand, you know, the fascination, especially in the context with which this movie has been made. You know, and like you said, Eric, there's no Batman here. There is no, I mean, it's just incessantly bad. And unpleasant to watch. I wanted to take a shower, after it was over. And I disliked it. I can't tell you how much I hated this movie. It was painful to sit through. I hated every frame of it. So I don't know. All right. So there it is. That's Joker. All right. What do we got?
Movie.
Yeah. What do we got next week?
Adam's Family.
Oh, right. Adam's Family, right.
Gemini Man.
Oh, God. I can't stand one Will Smith. Now I got to have two.
Yeah.
The new Almodovar film opens in Chicago.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. And Dolomite is My Name.
Oh, Dolomite is My Name. All right. There we go.
Let me just give a little kick. Next weekend midnight movie at the Music Box is a 4K restoration of the original Evil Dead.
Yeah, that's pretty spectacular right there.
I'm not missing that.
Yeah, no, that's pretty spectacular. 4K Evil Dead. That's fantastic.
It's going to look better than it's ever looked on the big screen.
No question about it. That's going to be fantastic. Now, is that going to be both Friday and Saturday?
Friday and Saturday on the big screen, in the big house.
In the big theater at the Music Box. Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Yep. All right, Steve, thanks, buddy.
Thanks.
Okay, Eric, let's jump into the box office.
Yes.
So, obviously, you know, Joker made a lot of money. Were people expecting it to make 90 and 93 million?
Yeah, I think this is exactly where people expect it to land. Some people were thinking that it could do over 100 million. I think everyone was expecting it to beat the record set by Venom last year, which was $80 million.
Yeah.
So I think somewhere right in that 90 million range is exactly where people are expecting it to land. it's kind of funny that it has almost the exact total that Justice League opened to, another awful DC movie.
Yeah.
And you know, this one is a little more. When Justice League made $93 million, everyone was like, "Oh no!"
Yeah.
And Joker makes the same amount. Everyone was like, "Yes, this is exactly what we wanted." Although I think that this movie will, I think there'll still be some curiosity next week, but I think that the negative vibes will start to catch up with this movie because it's not just you and me. Nick. I've seen the negative reactions are really starting to come out on on this movie.
Yeah.
And I think that it will fall, and I think that it'll probably end up somewhere in the vicinity of what Justice League made. But it's also made, you know, it's $234 million worldwide. I think the movie cost $80 million. So the Warner Bros. Is going to have a hit on their hands.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. No.
Abominable is with $12 million, bringing its total up to almost $38
million. Yeah, on a path to do $60 to $65 million. Not doing particularly well overseas right now. So this is looking like one of the rare, probably the biggest loser for Universal of the year so far.
Wow, okay. Downton Abbey, $8 million, $73.6 million. This is a solid hit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely it is. It looks like it's $100 million. That's out of the question, but it is going to pass Brokeback Mountain's $83 million and become Focus's highest grossing domestic film ever.
Wow, that's really amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. Number four, Hustlers, $6.3 million, $91 million total. That's really good.
Yeah, this one is going to hit $100 million. It's probably going to be somewhere around $105 to $110 million. A $20 million budget on this film. This is a movie that, again, I've said it before, is kind of temporarily saved STX Films. We'll see, if they can parlay this into something. But they're gonna need another hit pretty quick. But this is a nice little reprieve for them.
Yeah, that's cool. Number five, It Chapter Two, $5.3 million, $202 million total.
The $200 million line, still doing reasonably well worldwide. Not near the money that the first movie did, but I think most people are not as crazy about this one as the first one. But still a solid hit for Warner Brothers.
All right, Ad Astra. Wow, 43 million total.
Yeah, this one's going to barely just kind of limp over $50 million, if that even. It's doing okay overseas, so it's up to about 140 some million worldwide. But this one still needs about another 75-80 million for it to break even.
Wow, man, that's huge. Number seven, Judy, $4.4 million, $8.9 million total. Is per screen average still pretty good though?
Yeah, it bulked up its theater roadside, got this movie out to more people. It was only in 400 some theaters last week, so it's up to about 1,400 this week. So it's a lot more wide than it was last week, it's doing solid numbers right now. It's sort of on a path to do somewhere between 20 and 25 million. I think it'll just continue. It'll keep finding its audience, its core audience, and roadside. This is the second film of theirs this year after the Peanut Butter Falcon, which did surprisingly good numbers for a movie that just kind of came out of South by Southwest.
Yeah,
that movie's about to pass 19 million. That and Judy will eventually be two of their top five grossing films of all time.
And I will say this: I think it's going to have, as we get to award season, there's going to be a push for Zellweger. There's no question.
Oh, without question.
I think she's going to get nominated.
Some have already labeled her the winner. That's how far people are going.
She's amazing in the movie. So I don't know. All right. Well, Rambo: Last Blood, 39.8 total.
Yeah, kind of coming in right where the last one did. It's going to do a little bit more than the fourth movie, but it's $50 million budget. Not doing particularly well outside the U.S., as one might be expected for a Rambo movie this day and age. So this one's going to come up a bit of a loser as well.
All right, so are we looking at Joker to repeat next week?
Yeah, I don't even know if Gemini Man has that great an interest to it. I mean, even if Joker comes down to like high 30s, even, I think that might be enough to best Gemini Man last week or next week, because the reviews on the early stuff reviews on Gemini Man are not good.
Yeah.
Not good. So I think, Joker, Gemini Man, I'm very curious to see if people want to see an animated Addams Family movie.
Yeah.
I don't think they do.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong.
No, I mean, we've already had a bunch of Addams Family. This is like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I like the voice talent. I think it looks kind of funny. So I don't know. I mean, I'm going to see it over the weekend. So
yeah, and then people have already kind of seen the Hotel Transylvania movies too, which I think kind of, you know, satisfy right. that sort of similar kind of thing.
Right.
And you know, I don't know. I just go see Adam's Family Values.
Well, it's please that movie rules.
Yes, it does.
All right, Eric. Thanks, buddy, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
There you go, Eric Childress, and Steve Procopi join me every week to talk about the movies, and we'll do it again next week. All right, let's take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because we like to start your work week with a laugh. And my dad calls in, tells the joke. That'll be coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200. Ginger Baker passed away over the weekend. He was 80. He played drums for Cream and Blind Faith, and he was one of the best drummers ever that ever lived. So we're going to talk about Ginger Baker, remember his career, and then talk about some of the best drummers of all time. Also, Rip Taylor passed away over the weekend, and I love Rip Taylor. He's hilarious. I've always had a huge love for that guy. He was just so funny. And they were showing, you know, he passed away. So, you know, the game show, buzzer in the game show network, obviously Rip Taylor was a regular on a lot of game shows. And they showed this clip that featured, him. This is from Super Password when Bert Convy was the host of Super Password. And it was, Rip Taylor and, the other celebrity was the great, Patty Duke. And so as I was watching this clip, I realized that the three celebrities all have passed away. Like Rip Taylor, Bert Convy, and Patty Duke. And it made me kind of depressed, you know. But Rip Taylor did this bit where, like, because obviously he wore a wig, you know. And so he ripped the wig off at one point and threw it across the room, and then Bert Convy picked it up and stuck it in his vest, you know, and pretended that he had a hairy chest. And it was just that was the kind of stuff. And Patty Duke was losing it. She was laughing her head off. And it was just this great stuff that you can watch. And I'm hoping that they do some sort of tribute to him, you know, like Antenna TV, hopefully, or you know, did you ever see the movie, Tom, I'm assuming you've seen, Indecent Proposal.
Yeah.
That's the Demi Moore, Woody Harrelson, Robert Redford movie. And, Rip Taylor's in it, and it's a serious performance, and he doesn't have the toupee, and he's really good in it. And it, you know, it gives you, you know, you go back and think, like, maybe this guy could have been, you know, if he played more straight stuff, you know, like dramatic stuff, he might be able to do it, because he was terrific in that movie. And I remember it was a big deal, you know, like he's always had his toupee. You know what I mean? That was always one of his bits was the toupee. But like in that movie, no toupee, no confetti. And he played it pretty dramatically and straight in it, and it was really good. It was a really, really good performance. So if you've not seen Indecent Proposal, not a great movie. It's okay.
But he's great in it.
But he's really good in it, yeah. And it just shows you what he, you know, he could have accomplished if he wanted to do some more dramatic work. But man, he was funny. I mean, just ridiculously funny. Tim wants to make a comment about the movie Joker. Tim, go ahead.
Hi, Nick. I would just say I have a TV VCR DVD housing. The DVD crapped out of it for 2 years, but the rest of it still works. And I have Indecent Proposal on a VCR tape, but I can still throw it in. I can still record things the old-fashioned way. So, anyway, you know, I'm a mental health advocate, and I do some artist work. You know, I'm on social security disability because of my condition and whatever. But, you know, I was just in the hospital for 10 days. It's fine. You know, I'm trying to catch back up to my life, you know. anyway, the point is, I mean, the gentleman said this is going to be my last show, but it's, I mean, full disclosure, I haven't seen the movie. You know, I tried to call Dean yesterday morning, and, you know, they ran out of time, but it sounds like a pretty accurate description of someone who, you know, I try not to say off the rails, but that's what he is. You know, I sort of was the same way recently. You know, I've always known something was wrong with me. You know,
well, you know,
it feeds into the stigma.
Right. Yeah. I know. I understand. But the movie is really exploitive in that regard. It's very exploitive. And, you know, I know that there are a lot of troubled people out there and people have mental health issues. And it's very, very important that we treat them, you know, and take it very seriously. But this is not a movie that cares about that. You've seen it, Tom.
Yeah. I appreciate
it. Tim, thanks for the call.
I appreciated that, you know, maybe they were going to explore this. I think leading up to the movie, I was a little bit less cynical than you were, but still, like, can the guy who directed The Hangover and Old School and Starsky and Hutch realistically,
oh God, I forgot about Starsky and
yeah,
Hutch.
Can he walk that fine line and explore the character in that regard? And it just kind of fails miserably.
Yeah.
In that. And, you know, I don't think I disliked it as much as you did. There were things that I found enjoyable in it. But overall, like, it was fine. It didn't blow me away. But there are some people out there that cannot get over it. They're just like, this is great. This is the best movie of the year.
I don't understand that at all.
I don't really get it either, but there it is.
Yeah.
It's speaking to people on a certain level, I guess.
Yeah. But it is, I mean, you know, I mean, it's important that we don't, you know, people who have some mental illness or that we talk about that, you know, that
there
it's
are so many better movies. That
oh my God,
too.
So many better.
Yeah. And I hope that they continue making those movies and this doesn't become our stigma for how we
right.
approach this and be like, yeah, it's a cartoon. It's a,
right.
It's a villain.
Yeah. All right. Well, Tim, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, man. And, good luck to you. So Rip Taylor, as we were going to talk about here, Rip Taylor was just so funny. He was a comedian, did crazy stuff, and also hosted the $1.98 Beauty Show. If you remember that show, he was your host, a big Chuck Barris production right there. And Rip Taylor, you know, obviously appeared on The Gong Show and so many game shows and so many TV shows and made great appearances on The Tonight Show, and he was very, very funny. Known as the King of Confetti and the Crying Comedian, he made thousands of outlandish appearances on television and in nightclubs. Rip Taylor, the exuberant comedian whose zany shtick and over-the-top delivery made him a television and nightclub mainstay for more than six decades, has died. He was 84. Taylor died Sunday in Beverly Hills, his publicist announced. Taylor became a comedy legend through pure exhilaration, believing that all the more exaggerated the gag, the bigger the laugh. He overemphasized everything from his shaggy blonde toupee and bushy mustache to the campy props that were the basis of his bits. His jokes were far from cutting edge, but he would deliver them with such shrieking gusto that it was hard not to howl. The self-described King of Confetti, Taylor was famous for dousing his audience with buckets of colored paper, and anyone attending a Rip Taylor performance expected to be wearing confetti by the end of it. As he explained during a 2011 interview with Cliff Nesteroff for the classic television showbiz blog, his signature gag came about by accident. He said, "I did props, and I was a prop comedian. I was dying like hell on Merv Griffin's show. The jokes were dumb. I tore the 5x8 cards, threw them up in the air, and it became confetti. I knocked over his desk. I walked up the aisle, went to Sardi's, and said, well, that's the end of my television career. I went home that night. The switchboards had lit up. They said, get the guy that went crazy. And that's how the confetti started. One of the more memorable big screen appearances came when he played himself in Wayne's World. Oh, God, that's right. He was in Wayne's World 2.
Yep.
Totally forgot about that. A quest by Wayne to put on Wayne Stock. Oh, yeah, that's right. The Ultimate Music Festival gained stature when Taylor agrees to attend as a special guest. Rip Taylor's going to be there, Wayne tells Cassandra Wong, played by Tia Carrera, trying to convince her to perform. Rip Taylor, he's a god in my country, she says. He gets mobbed in the street. Taylor also appears as himself in the first three Jackass movies. Yes, he does.
And he's awesome.
He's fantastic. Taylor made for television He racked up more than 2,000 small screen credits during his career. According to RipTaylor.com, with dozens of mayhem-filled appearances on The Tonight Show and The Mike Douglas Show alone, his rapid-fire delivery, biting sarcasm, and self-deprecating humor also made him a perfect game show guest. He regularly showed up on the Hollywood Squares Match Game and Super Password. Chuck Barris took a liking to Taylor when he sat in as a panelist on The Gong Show, and when the game show guru conceived of a program to parody Miss America pageants, he tapped Taylor to host it. Certainly one of the oddest shows ever produced. Yes. That's to say the least, yes. The $1.98 beauty show featured six contestants of all shapes and sizes competing in talent and swimsuit competitions. When the winner was selected by three celebrity judges who never said a word, she was handed a gaudy Statue of Liberty crown, a bouquet of wilting vegetables, and a cash prize of $1.98, which Taylor would count out in change from a coin dispenser attached to his belt. You win the prize, you take the cake, you get the crown, and $1.98. Taylor would warble and when they're strutted down the plank of pulchritude. Charles Elmer Taylor Jr. was born January 13, 1935 in Washington, D.C. His father was a musician, his mother a waitress. As a teen, he attended Capitol Page School and served as a congressional page. What? I can't even imagine that.
Do you think he threw glitter on them too?
Oh my God,
confetti?
That's hilarious. That is hilarious. Can you imagine what I do now and what I did then, Taylor said during a 1990 interview. I knew I was a ham in those hallways because you had to wear a black suit and black knickers, and you'd all have to go under the catacombs to get to the Senate office building, the House office building, the Supreme Court to get a document for a congressman or a senator. But I went straight through the rotunda with all the tourists. I would say paging Senator Bilbo, who was hot at the time. He was the one in the papers. I was so hammy even then, I knew I was going to be in show business someday. After enlisting in the U.S. Army, he was assigned to the Signal Corps and ended up in special services where he entertained the troops in Tokyo and Korea. When he returned to civilian life, Taylor focused on a nightclub career, and his act consisted of pantomiming records. His favorites were Yiddish folk songs and Spike Jones tunes. It's easier using someone else's talent, he said. Very long story short, the record machine broke one day, and I haven't shut up since. Taylor played strip clubs up and down the East Coast in the mid-50s before coming up with his signature bit, crying. He found out that if he'd hold a handkerchief to his face and pretend to bawl, he'd get a bigger laugh. More upscale bookings followed, and he played all over Miami Beach. Taylor was also a regular in the Catskills. Once he got wind into booking agent from the Ed Sullivan show was going to be at his show. So he spent a week's salary playing with champagne and plying the audience with champagne so that they would loosen up and get loud. So he's getting the audience drunk. As I made my entrance that night, here's tonight's comic, Rip Taylor, and they all applauded. I said, not now, at the finish. The booking agent was in on the joke, and that's how I got my show in 1961. Thanks to Sullivan, he got booked. Everyone knew Taylor by his signature bit. When the host forgot Taylor's name and couldn't read the cue card, he introduced him as the crying comedian. It's as simple as that. Some same jokes that I did at 3 o'clock, I did at 8 o'clock, and I became the crying comedian. You can't make that stuff up. I mean, that's ridiculous. People forget your name, and they remember, oh, get the guy that does that. Get the guy that does that thing. Taylor was soon crying his way to the top. He made multiple appearances on Jackie Gleason's variety show, and Sullivan kept inviting him back. Eleanor Powell hired him to open for her in Las Vegas, and he went on to kick things off for the likes of Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Anne Margaret, Debbie Reynolds, Frankie Lane, Judy Garland, and the Kingston Trio. He was named Las Vegas Entertainer of the Year three times in the 70s. In 1967, Taylor showed up as a sobbing casino manager on an episode of The Monkees. Let's take a quick break here. Do you love the Rip Taylor? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. He always cracked me up. Always. So, the great Rip Taylor. Welcome Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago on 720 WGN here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Justin Kaufman in for Steve Cochran at 6. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Ginger Baker, the great drummer from Cream, has passed away. So we're going to talk about him, remember his career, and then talk about some of the best drummers ever in music. And we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Also passing away over the weekend, Rip Taylor. And by the way, Diane Carroll also passed away. Groundbreaking actress, and a really terrific actress too. Sad. And she passed away over the weekend too. The crying comedian, that's what he was known as. You can't make that stuff up. It's ridiculous. Rip Taylor was soon crying his way to the top. He made multiple appearances on Jackie Gleason's variety show. And in 1967, Taylor showed up as a sobbing casino manager on an episode of The Monkees. "Oh, officer, thank goodness you're here," he says to a police detective called to investigate a rigged roulette wheel. "I just found this wire attached to the wheel, and whenever I'd shift my stick, the house would lose a bet. Could you die?" He later played Alice's love interest in the 1977's The Brady Bunch Variety Hour. I do not remember that. Uncle Fester in a 1992 animated version of The Addams Family. And Chef Rappin' Rip on Life with Bonnie. among his film credits were Chatterbox. Oh, my God. Chatterbox, which is a comedy about a talking vagina.
What?
Oh, you're not familiar with Chatterbox?
No. Hold on. Was this a movie released in theaters?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah, Chatterbox.
Well, that sounds like pure cinematic joy.
And Rip Taylor's in it, man. He was also in The Happy Hooker Goes to Washington. He was in the Gong Show movie. Of course he was. And he portrayed a goofy maitre d' in Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
I totally forgot.
I've only seen that movie once. Mm-hmm. Indecent Proposal in 1993 and Silence of the Hams in 1994. 1979, Taylor made his Broadway debut in Sugar Babies, replacing Mickey Rooney in the lead. He toured the country playing Fagin in Oliver, Captain Hook and Peter Pan. Funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. In 2010, he debuted... Taylor debuted It Ain't All Confetti, a one-man show that he performed in North Hollywood. He was the subject of the 2016 documentary Rip Rip Hooray. Taylor, who kept his personal life private, was briefly married to Rusty Rowe, a Vegas showgirl, before they divorced. When author Brent Hardinger referred to him as, quote, openly gay in 2008, he reported that the comedian sent him a terse reply. And that reply was, You don't know me to summarize that I am openly gay, Taylor wrote. I don't know you are not an openly openly heroin user. You see how that works? Think before you write. He was a funny guy. He was a funny guy. Very unique guy. I used to really just look forward to him anytime he was on a talk show. He'd run out into the audience and do the confetti thing. Yeah, so... Anyway, he passed away, Rip Taylor. And Ginger Baker passed away over the weekend, too. Ginger Baker, who helped redefine the role of the drums in rock and became a superstar in the process, died on Sunday in a hospital in southeastern England. He was 80. Mr. Baker drew worldwide attention for his approach to the drums, as sophisticated as it was forceful, when he teamed with guitarist Eric Clapton and bassist Jack Bruce in the highly successful British band Cream in 1966. Keith Moon of The Who was more uninhibited. John Bonham of Led Zeppelin, a band that was formed in 1968, the year Cream broke up, was slicker, but Mr. Baker brought a new level of artistry to his instrument, and he was the first rock drummer to be prominently featured as a soloist and became a star in his own right. Mr. Clapton praised him as a fully formed musician whose musical capabilities are the full spectrum. Both as a member of the ensemble and a soloist, Mr. Baker captivated audiences earned the respect of fellow percussionists with playing that was, as Neil Peart, the drummer for the band Rush, once said, extrovert, primal, and inventive. Mr. Baker, Mr. Peart added, set the bar for rock drumming and what it could be. Which is absolutely true. Absolutely true. He was one of the best drummers of all time and influenced everybody. And, you know, you got a guy like Neil Peart, you know, widely considered one of the best drummers on the planet, to sing the praises of Ginger Baker. That's something. 815 area code says, with sad irony, this Saturday, Access TV reran the classics album of Cream's Disraeli Gears. Rest in peace, Ginger. Hi, Nick. Well, Rip Taylor always cracked me up. That's from Jay. It's because Rip Taylor is funny, man. He was just funny. So we've got a whole bunch of essential songs here that you can celebrate with Ginger Baker. And we're also going to talk about some other great drummers. But we want to hear from you. Who are some of the best, your favorite drummers? And if you got any Ginger Baker memories, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Mr. Baker got his start in jazz combos and cited the likes of Max Roach and Elvin Jones as influences, bristled when the word rock was applied to his playing. I'm a jazz drummer, he told British newspaper The Telegraph in 2013. You have to swing. There are hardly any rock drummers I know who can do that. Mr. Baker's appearance behind the drum kit, flaming red hair, flailing arms, eyes bulging with enthusiasm or shut tight in concentration, made an indelible impression. So unfortunately, did his well-publicized drug problems and his volatile personality. Mr. Baker, who by his own count quit heroin 29 times, was candid about his drug and alcohol abuse in his autobiography Hellraiser, which was published in Britain in 2009. He recalled driving from Los Angeles to San Francisco while on tour with the band Blind Faith in 69 and being more amused than surprised when he heard on the radio that he had died from a heroin overdose. That's got to be something right there. They're reporting that you're dead on the radio. You know, this reminds me of when Richard Pryor did Live on Sunset Strip after he had had his accident. Well, he set himself on fire.
Yeah.
He said that he was laying in the hospital bed, and they reported that he was dead on the TV. And he's like, no, I'm still alive.
That's got to be a weird feeling. I think the same thing happened to, like, Nikki Sixx. From Motley
Crue. Yes, it did.
They said he was dead, and everyone was just like, oh, man, is he? And he's just like watching people eulogize him on TV.
Right. So, okay, let's do this. Let's break, right? We got the news coming up.
Coming to me.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here, and we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Justin Kaufman in for Steve Cochran, who'll be back tomorrow at 6. That, of course, was Ginger Baker. Ginger Baker passed away over the weekend, a great drummer, classic artist, and he was with Cream and Blind Faith, and his work was legendary. And so we're remembering Ginger Baker. 804 area code says, Blind Faith is my top 10 album list. It's on my top 10 album list. Baker's drumming on Can't Find My Way Home is classic. 807 area code says, best rock drummer is Neil Peart, not only a drummer, but also Rush's lyricist. He writes a lot of silly songs, man.
There's Trouble in the Forest.
Oh, my God. Trees.
I love that song so much.
Man.
The trees.
Ridiculous. But yeah, he's certainly considered one of the greatest drummers of all time. There's no question about it. Let's see. Of a later tour he wrote in, this is Ginger Baker, in 1983-84, I formed the Ginger Baker Trio with guitarist John Sims and bassist Ian McDonald. And we did a tour that included Malta, Spain, and Germany, but I can't remember anything about it due to the fact that I was drinking so heavily. He was also, by all accounts, not a very likable man. We were talking about this documentary a little bit earlier. Journalists who interviewed him tended to find him uncooperative at best, confrontational at worst. The hostility between Mr. Baker and Mr. Bruce, which sometimes led to onstage altercations, was the stuff of rock legend. In the 2012 documentary Beware of Mr. Baker, the title is taken from a sign outside of the house in South Africa where he was living at the time, begins with footage of Mr. Baker physically attacking the film's director, Jay Bolger. If they've got a problem with me, come and see me and punch me in the nose, Mr. Baker says in the film. I'm not going to sue you. I'm just going to hit you back. But if he was difficult to deal with, his talent was impossible to ignore. As A.O. Scott of the New York Times noted in his review of Beware of Mr. Baker, Mr. Baker's music is ultimately the only reason anyone should take interest in him. So, there you go. Not an easy guy to get along with.
And that opening of Beware Mr. Baker is so funny. It's, just hits him right in the face with his cane.
Yeah.
And he's bleeding, too. Yeah. He's bleeding bad.
Yeah. Oh, man. He was something. He was something. In 2009, Ginger Baker demanded I come live with him in South Africa to write his story. And this is Jay Bolger. This is the guy who ended up getting popped. Says, it was my lifelong dream becoming a Rolling Stone journalist. I did it, but the article wasn't enough for Ginger. He insisted that I make a movie about him so they can hear the music, idiot. After I directed Beware of Mr. Baker, an award-winning documentary, he responded, you can take your awards and shove them up your butt. Whatever I did, it was never enough for Ginger. I like to think he held me to some impossible standard he held himself. I owe him so much, I'm glad he's no longer in pain. Yeah. Is Ginger Baker's body was failing him, and at 80 years old, he couldn't play double bass drums with the intensity he asked of himself. And yet, up until last spring, he did just that, climbing on stage with a catheter bag, supporting his family the only way he knew. Wow. We got a couple of texts coming in. If you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312 area code says, while waiting for Rush at the Aragon, they let us in early and they put a concert of Cream on the film, and it was great to see Ginger Baker on the drums. 815 area code says, I'll take Carl Palmer over Neil Peart. Both great drummers, though. And I would agree with that, I think. So, Ginger Baker passed away, which gets us to talking about drummers. Do you have a favorite drummer?
Yeah, I'm
Bonham?
It's Bonham.
Yeah,
he's remarkable. He synthesized all the best parts of so many different styles of drumming, and the guy could groove like no one else.
Well, and he also, you know, nobody hit the Skins harder.
Yeah,
and he had like what was the weight of his sticks?
Yeah, exactly. Were always really heavy. He called them like tree trunks.
Nuts.
Yeah, he would always play with really heavy sticks.
Yeah,
especially when he practiced, and then he would go down just a little bit when he performed live, so that he could go even faster because he was trained on heavier sticks.
Yeah, no, he was something. He was something, and it was back in those days. It would be like, you know, back in the 70s, that was when you could get away with a 20-minute drum solo. I mean, they actually have a studio recorded song on Zeppelin 2 with a drum solo, which is, you know, I mean, it's Moby Dick.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You know what my friend says about that song?
What?
He's not crazy about it.
Yeah.
He's like, he goes, that song is a waste of a perfectly good riff.
I mean, I can't say I disagree, but at the same time, it's totally self-indulgent, but it's one of those things where it's like you either appreciate the inherent value of percussion or you don't.
Yeah.
Because what he's doing is really interesting. He's building off of Ginger Baker in terms of getting more jazzy with some of what he's doing, really finding like the value in the groove.
Yeah.
And especially Ginger, he played with Fela Kuti. Mm-hmm. And Felix Cootie loved him, even though he was a jerk.
Yeah.
But he was like, yeah, this is one of the only white dudes that understands the African beat and the Afrobeat scene and is able to play along with these ridiculously syncopated beats.
Well, you know what's crazy about Bonham is just the live shows were so self-indulgent. I mean, well, that was Zeppelin, man.
Yeah, that when was did Zeppelin. The gong come into it?
I mean, gong?
Yeah, wasn't there at one point he had a gong behind him?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought you were talking about the band Gong.
No.
Oh.
Speaking of self-indulgent.
Yeah. I love Gong. But yeah, no, he had a gong. He had two of them.
Two gongs.
Yeah. You don't mess around. No, but I liked, you know, he would play with his hands.
Yeah, yeah.
You just, you know, at one point during his 27-minute drum solo, he would bust out his hands, start playing them.
Everybody's too lit up to care.
Yeah. Well, they're all drunk. You know, like, I saw Zeppelin... I saw them twice. I saw them in 75, and they were great. And then I saw them in 77, and they were terrible. They were terrible in 77. And that was, like, widely considered one of the most disastrous rock tours of all time. They were promoting Presence, was the record. And but they were terrible in 77 because they were loaded. They were all loaded, you know, like the only sober person on that stage when I saw them was John Paul Jones, and he was not happy.
No.
He was always the pro out of those guys.
I mean, he was the only one that was classically trained outside. I think Jimmy might have had a decent amount of music education just from being a session guy when he was really young.
Yeah.
You know, playing skiffle in the streets with all the other kids, but... Now, John Paul Jones went on to have a big career just, you know, composing stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he composed orchestra bits for, like, R.E.M.
Yeah, no. And he produced records and had quite a career outside of just being with Zeppelin. But it was funny because, like, you know, when I saw him in 77, they were so drunk. I mean, you know, Page did most of the show from a folding chair. And Plant would always come out, like when Robert Plant would come out, like he would crack open a bottle. He would break the seal and crack open a bottle of Jack. That would be his first. Well, he came out that night. The bottle was 3/4 of the way empty already. This was at the beginning of the show.
I don't know what kind of person it takes. You know, it's intense.
Yeah.
To go out there and then perform. It's one thing to get loaded.
No, it is. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the amount of booze and drugs that those guys ingested. It's incredible that they're alive. Well, Bonham's not.
Yeah.
But it's incredible that the other guys are alive. Page and Plant are still kicking. And Plant can still sing. You know? But, yeah, those were the days, man.
The all-or-nothing days.
Oh,
you know?
My God. Anyway, he said, as we mentioned, we're talking about drummers here. And Bonham was a magnificent drummer.
Yeah, there's some beats on those Led Zeppelin albums that are just undeniably good and layered and complicated and just fun to listen to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there are some just absolutely classic drum parts to those Zeppelin songs. I mean, when the levee breaks, what are we talking about here?
And the way they were thinking production-wise, they're just like, yeah, let's get in a really big echoey room. It's going to sound great.
Yeah, I mean, When the Levee Breaks is one of the greatest drum beats in, you know, in music history. And nobody sounds like Bonham.
No.
You know, there are not many drummers that sound like Bonham. Actually, nobody ever sounded like Bonham.
Even his own son barely sounds like Bonham.
Yeah. All right. We're talking about drummers here. Who are some of your favorites? Ginger Baker passed away, and he was a fantastic drummer. And so we're talking about drums and drumming. 312-981-7200 for talk or text. 312-981-7200. So here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, a picture-perfect fall day. Unlimited sunshine under nearly cloudless skies. The highs are going to reach into the middle to upper 60s, turning a little cooler at the lakeside in the afternoon. And lows range from the lower to middle 40s inland to near 50 downtown. For tomorrow, another delightful fall day with abundant sunshine and light winds. Highs will approach 70s inland, closer to 60 near the lake. For Wednesday, the fall weather trifecta brings another sunny and mild day with highs peaking around 5 degrees above seasonable normals. Thursday, still sunny, But mid and high-level clouds increase during the afternoon. Temperatures will reach the low to mid-70s. Clouds gather at night with a chance of showers by daybreak. And then for Friday, mostly cloudy, windy, mild, with clusters of showers or gusty thunderstorms. Highs will reach the upper 60s, turning colder late at night. It's currently 53 degrees at O'Hare. It's 54 at Midway and 56 at the lakefront. Really nice weather coming our way for the next couple of days. All right, let's take a quick break and we'll come back. We're talking about drums, your favorite drummers, who are the best. And I do have a list here that was put together by, what is this? Where is this from?
This is Rolling Stone.
Oh, it's Rolling Stone, the 100 greatest drummers of all time. Okay, we'll have to look at this list and see if we agree. So, all right, we'll take a break and we'll come back with more right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom coming up. Ginger Baker passed away, unfortunately. A tremendously talented man and a great, great drummer. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about some of the greatest drummers of all time. 312-981-7200. Let's see. We got some text. 773 area code said Carl Palmer of ELP and Clive Burr of Iron Maiden. Both great drummers. 773 area code, Phil Collins is a good drummer. 630 area code, Stuart Copeland. Stuart Copeland, one of my favorites. Nobody plays the drums like Stuart Copeland. He's a great drummer.
I think definitely a student of Ginger Baker, too, because I think there was a lot of things that he liked about it and incorporated into his own very unique style.
815 area code says you cannot leave out Bill Lorden or Billy Caldwell. Steve from Galesburg says Keith Moon is a legend for his antics alone, not to mention being an amazing drummer. Keith Moon was a lunatic. Crazy drummer, though. Yeah. And I always go back to the story every time we mention Keith Moon. Go back to the story when he decided to take horse tranquilizers before a gig. Because, you know, that's Keith Moon. Right before a gig, he decides he's going to load up on horse tranks. So he does. Halfway through the second song, boom, he's out. Passes out. And it's a true story. And then Pete Townsend said, does anybody, you know, they're in front of a, they just started. So Pete Townsend goes up to the microphone and says, listen, is there anybody out there that can play drums? And some 18-year-old kid in the audience said, yeah, I can play drums. So they bring this guy up. Meanwhile, you know, Keith Moon is being carted off the stage, passed out on horse tranquilizers. And so they bring this kid up, and he played drums with the Who. It's like what, it's an incredible story, but it's true. So Michelle in Geneva said Roger Taylor, vastly underrated, total powerhouse. He and John Deacon were one of the finest rhythm sections ever. Not just anyone could back Freddie Mercury. Yeah, it's true. Great band. Efren in Pilsen says, Keith Moon on the double album Quadrophenia is the absolute greatest drumming I have ever heard from. 773 area code says, John Bonham's best drumming to me is on Achilles' Last Stand. That song is a jam. Um, 815 area code says David Abruzzese will never make a top drummer list. He was better than the two for PJ. Hot topic button for fans. Underrated. Not sure why he was blackballed. So we've got here from Rolling Stone their list of the best drummers, greatest drummers of all time. And we're going to go through that. And so we're talking drummers. You know who my favorite drummer is? I don't know if have we ever talked about my favorite drummer?
Well, I know Stuart Copeland's one of them.
He's one of them. My favorite drummer, I think the best drummer on the planet, is Carter Beauford from Dave Matthews.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's unbelievable. He's unbelievable.
In terms of drummers working a day?
He is, totally. Without question. And the other thing about Carter Beauford is that he's constantly smiling and blowing bubbles. He's the happiest guy in the world. And I mean, I love that band. I mean, because the musicians in that, think what you will about Dave Matthews. I know a lot of people don't like him, but those musicians on that stage are unbelievable. They're insanely talented.
Dave Matthews is a genius for getting all those people on the same stage.
Yeah.
And I'm not a Dave Matthews person, but I got tipped the cap.
I mean, these are like these are top musicians. And Carter Beauford, man, I think he's the best drummer on the planet right now. And again, it's effortless. It looks just effortless. He's always smiling. He's doing stuff I've never seen. He's doing stuff that very, you know, few drummers can do. And he's doing it laughing and blowing bubbles. He's ridiculous. But he's my favorite. He's my favorite drummer on the planet right now. I could watch that guy play. I mean, it's insane. Here's Mike on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hey, what's up, Nick?
Hey.
One of my favorite drummers of all time, Mitch Mitchell of Jimi Hendrix,
sure.
Hendrix Experience.
Yeah.
And also Billy Kreutzmann of the Grateful Dead, another consummate drummer.
Yeah.
And a great session guy was Bill Bruford.
Bill Bruford is a great drummer. A great drummer.
He is a great drummer. Yeah. I think he played with Yes for a while.
He did.
He played with everybody.
Yeah, no, he played with Yes for years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the greats.
Yep.
Hey, great show, Nick.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks a lot.
Take care,
it.
Buddy. Yeah, Mitch Mitchell. Mitch Mitchell, man. Wild man. Wild man. He was as crazy on the drums as Hendrix was on the guitar. Watch those guys, man. Amazing.
Especially when you've got some concerts where they play like fire, like just double time. We're going to play this as fast as possible.
Yeah. All right, let's look at some of these contributions here. Travis Barker from Blink 182 makes the list. I don't really know enough about them.
He's pretty good. I don't like them, but he's pretty good. He can definitely go fast. He can definitely meet the pace that he needs to meet.
Yeah. Coming up 98, Steven Adler from the Guns N' Roses. Boy, he almost, he really screwed up his life, man. But yeah, I mean, back in the day when GNR were big, yeah, he was considered a pretty great, a great drummer. Cindy Blackman. Oh, Lenny Kravitz. Oh, she's good. Oh, man. I didn't know that was what her name was. Cindy Blackman. I love her, man. She can play. She rocks, man.
And I'm not a huge Lenny Kravitz person.
I'm not either.
I've always appreciated his rhythm section is impeccable.
No, she's unbelievable. She's unbelievable. I saw Lenny Kravitz because he opened for the Stones. When I saw the Stones at Soldier Field for the Voodoo Lounge tour, whenever that was. And he was great. I mean, he did all the hits. You know what I mean? He got up there and he did all the Lenny Kravitz hits. But his band was amazing. Amazing. Here's Mark on WGN. Hi, Mark.
Greetings from Cleveland.
Yeah.
I think that Martin Atkins deserves a mention for his work with Public Image Limited alone.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Great stuff. Really, really, really great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, first, he auditioned to be with the band with a song called Bad Baby, and it was good enough that they actually released it on the album. And then the bassist left, and the next album, Flowers of Romance, he was basically the lead drummer on that because, it was just vocals, guitar, and his drums dominating pretty much everything, and he did an awesome job.
Yeah. All right. Very cool. Thank you, Mark.
Have a great show.
All right, take care. Next here on the list, Larry Mullen Jr. 96 is about right.
Yeah, I mean, he's a talented guy, but he doesn't really
have... He's solid.
He keeps the beat. He keeps what's going on, you know, not too flashy.
He gets the job done.
Yeah. I will say Sunday Bloody Sunday, still great drum work.
Yeah. So, okay, we got a break here. The news is coming up after this. The David Caruso just make a smart-ass remark and put on his sunglasses? You know, I assume, Tom, that you've gone down that rabbit hole on YouTube where they have like 45 minutes of just David Caruso saying smart aleck lines before the credits of
CSI Miami. Yeah. No, it was a guilty pleasure of mine for a while. It was always the funniest thing.
Oh, it's hilarious.
It's just so absurd that they were like, yeah, you know what's going to make this guy cool? Making smart aleck comments followed right. by the who.
And putting sunglasses. The sunglasses are the really important part.
This is a really dumb pun, too.
It's just stupid. It's the stupidest thing in the world, but it's funny every time.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone to YouTube, and I'm not kidding. I've watched like 20 minutes of that. All it is just the opening, whatever smart aleck comment David Caruso says, followed by, yeah! And then, well, maybe he's going to be late for dinner. Yeah! You know. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Here until 5 o'clock. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. But right now we're talking about drummers. Ginger Baker passed away over the weekend. He was one of the best drummers ever. And so we're talking about our favorite drummers. Who are the best drummers? We want to hear from you guys. Here's Rob on WGN. Hi, Rob.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right, what's up?
Like I told before, I got to go with my boy Charlie Watts. I'm a diehard Stones fan. I've only missed one concert. That was in 72 when I was in the service. But for probably the generation of the early to mid-1950s, all the way up through the early 60s, probably the drummer that influenced the most kids. Now, I'm talking to kids up to, you know, mid-age teenagers. Probably Cubby O'Brien from the Mickey Mouse Club.
Oh, okay.
And as I was saying, I believe at the time, Mattel with Walt Disney, and that they even came out with a set of Mattel Cubby O'Brien drums that you could buy.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
And, I got to go with my boy Charlie Watts. And like I said, Cubby O'Brien, that's the first one I can remember from.
Right.
I'm telling my age now, but.
Right. All right. Thanks, Bob. Rob, take care, buddy.
All right. You guys have a good one.
Charlie Watts, legendary. He's another one of those guys that just. It's effortless, you know? So 312-981-7200. Here is Robert in Wicker Park. Hi, Robert.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
Morning.
Great topic.
Yeah.
I got three threesomes for you. Mark Farner, Grand Funk Railroad.
Okay.
And his name escapes me right now, but the guy from Triumph, another threesome. And Frank Beard from ZZ Top.
All right, Frank Beard. His name is Beard, but he's the only guy in the band that doesn't have a beard.
Right, and give your producer, Tom, a little hard time for not knowing who Triumph is.
You don't know Triumph?
It's not ringing a bell, man.
Oh, man.
Is that a comic dog or something?
No, Triumph is they're a Canadian rock band, man.
The lead guitarist is their lead singer. His name is his last name's Levin. I can't think of the drummer's name though.
All right.
He's awesome.
Okay.
Three guys,
thanks,
man.
Robert.
All right.
Take care.
Rock out.
Triumph. You know everybody. Lay it on the line. Lay it on the line. You're not familiar with Triumph?
No.
Man, they rock.
Unless it's an insult comic dog, then no.
No, man. I can't believe you don't know Triumph. Canadian Bill probably knows Triumph very well, because they are a Canadian rock band. All right, how about this? Meg White is on the list. Yeah. We got some more texts here coming in. 312-981-7200. 262 area code. One of the most underrated drummers was Ronnie Tutt. He was Elvis's drummer. Elvis always had great musicians. Always. 815 area code says Kenny Aronoff, highly adaptive, creates a conversation through drumming, can play any style at any speed. Dino says Animal from Sesame Street. Was he ever on Sesame Street? I think he was just on The Muppets, right? Was Animal on Sesame Street? I think he was just on The Muppets.
Yeah, he was just on The Muppet Show. Yeah. But he, I guess you can consider the Sesame Street also like a subset of The Muppets.
I guess. 815 area code, Rick Allen, the one-armed bandit from Def Leppard. That's amazing that he continued to play after that horrible accident.
Well, I've told you about how my parents both independently met Def Leppard on two different occasions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dad played soccer against him, and he was in goal, the one-armed drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Not too bad, either.
How about Ralph Molina, who played with everybody? He was with Buffalo Springfield, played with Neil Young, mostly. A great drummer. Janet Weiss.
She just left Sleater-Kinney.
She did, yeah.
Yeah.
Bill Chippendale is considered one of the best drummers. So, Bill Stevenson, Fallout Boy.
I don't know if I would put him on there.
John Theodore
from the Mars Volta.
Yeah,
one of the best.
John Theodore. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Yeah. You know, it's another. Do people do drum solos anymore? Like in concert?
I mean,
do they do the 15-minute?
No, they don't do 15 minutes.
We
but
do 15 minutes where everybody leaves the stage except for the drummer.
I wish. That'd be pretty cool, but I think people are more focused on their ability to play beats, you know?
What about Tommy Lee?
What about Tommy Lee?
He's a good drummer.
Yeah.
He is. He's a good drummer. He's an good. Idiot. He's an idiot, but he's a good drummer.
Didn't he do the thing where he got in the cage and it rolled
around?
Oh, yeah.
He would go out. It would lift up over the audience, and he would spin around upside down and stuff. Oh, yeah. Very entertaining. Very, very entertaining. Oh, man. All right. Longtime AC/DC drummer Phil Rudd. That's about as solid as you can get right there. That's pretty solid right there. Phil Rudd from the AC/DC. Oh, yeah. Tommy Lee. He's on the list, too. Tommy Lee's gravity-defying drum solos and penchant for wearing as few clothes as possible made him one of metal's truly great showmen, but his bashing in Motley Crue was just as important as his star power. Lee's frenetic clatter helped define the glam-punk appeal of Motley's debut Too Fast for Love, while the earth-shaking beat that powered Dr. Feelgood's title soundtrack sounded as menacing as it did overwhelming. So, yeah. How about that? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We want to hear from you. We're talking about great drummers. Ginger Baker passed away, unfortunately, and he was one of the best. And so now we're talking about drummers, your favorite drummers. 312-981-7200 right here on this Monday morning. Not my tempo.
Were you rushing or are you dragging?
Oh, man, I love this movie. I love that movie so much. It's Whiplash, talking about drumming. You know, I remember watching that. I watched that movie with my parents, my dad. My dad, who can, like, if he's at home, he can't sit down for, he can't, like, sit and relax for, like, more than a half an hour before he has to get up and do something or leave or something. He did not move from his chair when we watched Whiplash. That was a testament to how great that movie is, to get my dad to not move, because normally he's up, he's walking around, he'd go outside, go get a newspaper, something like that, because he's always got to move.
Yeah, he's got the energy.
But he did not move at all during Whiplash. And man, I'm telling you, when that car, when the car accident happens, My dad's like, like he couldn't believe, he was like completely freaked out. It's a shocking moment in the movie.
Totally. Too. Out of nowhere.
Yeah. Wow, that's a good movie. Man. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Speaking of my dad, he's going to call in a little bit later on to tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We're talking about Gwait?
Wascally Wabbits.
What? All right. Let's see. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you guys want to jump in here. Here is Tim on WGN. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how's it going, Nick?
All right.
Ainsley Dunbar.
Great drummer.
Used to do with Journey.
Yep.
Saw him in the late 70s at Chicago Fest. That was, I remember that. And then I think he was with Jefferson Airplane.
He was, I think,
Now, and I think Santana. And Santana.
Yeah, Ainsley Dunbar has played with everybody. And he's a fantastic drummer.
Right.
Yeah.
And Nick, you got to do another show about favorite concerts that you've been to. That was the most popular I heard on the radio.
Uh-huh.
I've been to so many concerts, from the Stones to NXS to U2. You get people calling all night long about that on that show.
All right, Tim, thanks.
All right.
Take care, buddy.
Bye.
Ainsley Dunbar. Yep. 312-981-7200. Here's Mitch on WGN. Hi, Mitch.
Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So, I would have to say, and again, it's very subjective, and most people I don't think realize how great he is because of his time with Journey. He's back with Journey again now, playing a monstrous sonor kit. But Steve Smith...
He's great.
His technique is just off the charts. He makes it look effortless. And I think he was voted number one by readers of Modern Drummer magazine like 4 or 5 times out of 10 years. I mean, he's just amazing. A lot of these guys, some people would call them jazz drummers, but I mean, if you can play jazz, great. You can sit in with a rock band and drink coffee while you're playing. I mean, it's just so much simpler music.
Yeah.
But the guy, I tell you, there's a drum solo out there right now, and I'm not big on drum solos. By the way, Steve Smith still does about a 10-minute drum solo at every Journey concert, and the place goes crazy because it's a musical solo. It actually sounds like music, not just some guy buzzing around the kit. Simon Phillips comes to mind. He was the only guy, I can't think of a guitar player for Toto, but when they left Jeff Porcaro, lost Jeff Porcaro when he passed away, he said that the only way he would go on playing with Toto is if Simon Phillips would agree to play drums for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's off the charts. But, you know, there's a solo out there right now by Todd Sugarman, who plays with Styx now, and you wouldn't really have him pop up. His solo is the most beautiful, melodic, intricate, technically sound solo I've ever heard. And it's only recorded like 6 months ago, and it's an amazing solo.
All right. All right, Mitch.
And I'm surprised you like Whiplash.
Why?
Well, you know, when that movie came out, I had people emailing me and asking me on Facebook if I had seen it. Have you seen Whiplash? Have you seen Whiplash? So I was all excited, and then I finally saw it. And I said, okay, without trying to offend people too much, I was asked what I thought about Whiplash, and I will only say this. Normally, drumming is not a blood sport. I just thought, if somebody's hands are bleeding while they play drums, they probably need to visit their teachers again and have their technique fixed. Your hands are bleeding, you're doing it wrong.
All right. Thanks, Mitch.
All right.
Take care. I will say this, Tom. You know how we have bands in every once in a while. Well, when Whiplash was out, we had a couple of bands in here, and I asked the drummer of two different bands what they thought of Whiplash, and they both hated it.
A lot of people who play drums.
A lot of people who play drums can't stand that movie because the technique is wrong. You know,
it's true.
I don't care. I love that movie.
Yeah, for me, it's not so much about the realism. I understand that, like, any movie about music like that is going to have some issues. But
yeah,
And people who really love jazz took a lot of issue with that movie. Yeah. They were just like, you can't, this is not what jazz is like.
Yeah.
But then again, you talk to people who go to performing arts schools, the intensity is the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not necessarily the jazz, but
J.K. Simmons is unbelievable in it. He's unbelievable in it.
Daddy didn't love you.
You know, it's really, you know, that was the first movie where I ever saw, because I guess this is a popular thing now where people, you know, like when Paul Reiser pours the raisinettes into the popcorn, that's the first time I had ever even heard of that. I was like, what is he doing? But I guess that's a thing.
I thought that was super weird. And then yeah. I started meeting people who were like, oh yeah, I do that all the time.
I know. I was like, what? Because when I saw the movie, I was like, this is just weird. But then I guess that's a popular thing. Pour your goobers or your raisinettes into the popcorn. Then you get the sweetened, salty. I still think it's weird. Here's Chris on WGNI, Chris.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
All right, what's up?
Hey, you know the band Godsmack?
Yes.
There's a video where the lead singer, as their drummer does his solo, they bring out a whole nother set, and he gets behind it, and they have a kind of like a drum off. But Sully uses his hands.
Mm.
And then after they have a little crescendo on that, they go into some old Rush, some Black Sabbath, just like a couple of minutes of each song. It's a great drum solo.
Oh, okay. We'll have to look at that.
Oh, and I got an autographed Carmine Appice drumstick when Vanilla Fudge came back together for a reunion tour.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing.
I've interviewed him. I've had him on my show.
Great drummer.
Yeah,
great
tremendous,
drummer.
Tremendous. Yeah. Tremendous.
All right, Nick. Thanks.
Okay. All right, Chris. Take care.
Bye.
Yeah, he wrote a book, Carmine Appice. Now, it's weird because, like, his brother says Appice. It's Carmine Appice. Wait a minute. How does he? Because his brother pronounces his last name differently. So, let's see. 309 area code, Johnny Carson show favorite, Buddy Rich. Oh, man, what a jerk that guy was.
Yeah, but boy, could he play.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he could play. You ever hear his tapes? You ever hear the tapes of Buddy Rich on his bus? Because Buddy Rich was a massive jerk and would have these insane rules for his band. And so... He was just such a massive jerk screaming at the band all the time that guys started to record him without him knowing it. Like, he'd be on the bass. Have you heard these things?
Yeah. It's legendary.
It's completely legendary. And so the guys in the band were like, all right, we're just going to record this jerk. And so there's like hours of footage of just of audio that they recorded without Buddy Rich knowing on the bus screaming at the band. It's hilarious.
Meanwhile, he's appearing on the Muppet Show doing cute bits.
Yeah. Hilarious. And he was always such a jerk on The Tonight Show, too. I mean, he was on all the time. He's an amazing drummer. Okay, Buddy Rich was an unbelievable drummer. There's no question about it. But, man, I mean, just like, you go back and watch those reruns. You can watch them on Antenna TV, by the way. They're awesome. 9 o'clock every night, Johnny Carson reruns. And you're bound to see Buddy Rich at some point. Showing up on the Tonight Show reruns, wearing really bad clothes. Too.
Yeah. Oh wow.
Like really bad 70s clothes. Oh man, but the guy could play.
Yeah, I still listen when I want to get jazzed up. I want to listen to when he does the bugle call rag.
Yeah,
it's just so good.
He was an amazing drummer. Amazing. Okay, we're gonna break here, and we've got the news coming up. Right after this, right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. So it is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we've been talking about best drummers. Ginger Baker passed away, and so we wanted to talk about some great drummers and some great drumming. And we got a bunch of texts that are coming in. We want to hear more from you at 312-981-7200. Tommy in Johnsburg says, hey, guys, how about Taylor Hawkins or Dave Grohl? Foo Fighters, both great drummers. Dave Grohl's, you know, it's so crazy that Dave Grohl has become like this incredible front man. Because he's a great drummer. He's a fantastic drummer. And when he made that transition, you know, to front man, and he's so good. And he's also one of the coolest guys in rock. Like, he's really, like, just a really cool guy. And Foo Fighters, man, boy, did they take off.
Yeah. I mean, to the point where, you know, people started forgetting where he came from, more or less.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, he's the drummer of Nirvana? No way.
Glenn in Evanston says, Vinny Appice. That's how you pronounce it, Appice and Appice. Vinny Appice, Dio's drummer, is one of the best ever. 773 area code says, one of the best in the last 30 years has been Jimmy Chamberlain. 815 area code says, Tommy Clufidos, Black Sabbath's current drummer, still plays I Can't Believe What I'm Seeing and Hearing a drum solo. That was a big, you know what, man? I'll tell you something, though. It's a big shoes to fill. Bill Ward, man.
That guy could groove.
Oh,
holy cow.
Oh, my God.
Again, I think he also had a jazz background.
I'm sure he did.
Because what he was doing was not like typical heavy metal stuff. It could swing.
Yeah. I mean, he was fantastic. 815 area code says, no quarter Led Zeppelin tribute band's drummer does a long solo on Moby Dick. It's awesome. So they can, no quarter the Zeppelin tribute band? All right. Hey, Nick, great show. Pete from Crystal Lake here. Hey, what about the original Boston drummer, John Thomas, also known as Sib Hashian? All right. 708 area code says, Jim from Crestwood, his name escapes me, but the drummer from the Allman Brothers was fantastic. Okay. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's see. Jeff Porcaro, which somebody mentioned already, from Toto. Steve Smith was mentioned already. How about Questlove?
Yeah.
Great drummer.
Very good drummer.
And great hair.
Great clothes.
Yeah.
Great taste, man.
Yeah.
All around.
How did Jimmy Fallon end up getting that band for their...
I don't know.
I mean, how did that happen?
The Roots are way too cool for Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, my God, yes.
But, you know, it got them a steady gig so they could just kind of, you know, lead
normal
lives
for the
first time.
I'm happy for them. You know what I mean? It's a high-profile gig. It's just that, man, Jimmy Fallon has the best band in late night. It's the best band in late night. We just, you know, it's the Roots, man. Let's see. Mickey Hart. Oh, sure. Classic. How about Roger Hawkins? Legendary. Let's see. Yeah, Questlove is here. He's number 54. I think that's a little low for Questlove. So, how about this? Jerome Bigfoot Braley.
Who do you play for?
Parliament.
Oh, man. Oh, wow.
Yeah, man. Parliament Funkadelic.
Jeez.
Yeah. Here's one of my favorite drummers of all time. Tony Thompson. Tony Thompson was just so good. He was just such a great drummer. And he played with Power Station, too. He was with he played with Chic. And then he was on the Power Station album. He was such a great drummer, Tony Thompson. He was such a great drummer. Watch that guy play drums all day long. Hey, Mick Fleetwood.
Not a bad, no.
No, he's good.
What? Where is he coming in at?
Where is he? 62?
That's, yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry, 60.
60.
Yeah. 60. Let's see. You know, it's interesting to, you know, when you're watching some people, there's sort of some unknown drummers that are probably really, really great that we aren't even touching upon. You know, how about Sheila E?
Oh, yeah.
She's great.
Yeah. I remember, was it Letterman that used to do Drum Solo Week?
Yes, it was Letterman.
Yeah, Letterman did Drum Solo Week, and she got a drum solo, and it was insane.
Oh, she's nuts, man. She's nuts. Yeah. I've seen her live a bunch of times, and she opened for Prince, obviously, and she is just amazing. Here's what they say about Carter Beauford, who, for my money, is my favorite drummer right now. It says, a founding member of the Dave Matthews Band, Carter Beauford is a chops-heavy jazz drummer and Tony Williams fan with pop sensibilities. Though his band depends on groove, he fills out even their most popular tracks with wildly complicated, incredibly busy licks. For example, giving Ants Marching an unlikely hi-hat pattern before orchestrally accenting Dave Matthews' vocal stabs, adding a tricky bass drum work to So Much to Say, and treating Dancing Nancy's a second line that stops at Stuart Copeland's house, or using two snares on two-step. And, of course, there's the live shows where his monster drum solos explode in double-kick frenzies and songs evolve from night to night. Every audience is different, so we try to speak directly to that audience or deliver a different message every time we play, Beauford said to told Guitar Center. If you play the same thing every time, the word will get out. Yeah, seriously, it's amazing to watch that guy play drums. It really is. Carter Beauford, amazing. Let's see. Here is Frank on WGN. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a program called Yvonne's Piano. It used to be a half an hour each time. Sometimes you get them back to back. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Joel Spencer, very good jazz drummer. And you're going back to big bands, speaking of big bands, Billy Joe Jones, worked with Miles Davis, mm-hmm. Red Garland, John Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pop over to Roy Haynes and with Charlie Parker, Billie Holiday era, with Lester Young and Coltrane also, with Stan Getz.
Right. Yeah.
Chick Corea. And, oh, man, there's just so many. Gene Krupa, when I grew up, he was my idol.
Yeah.
And then came Buddy Rich, Max Roach.
Yeah, there's a lot. And, there are so many great drummers that have, that have been around. It's a big long list for sure. So, all right, Frank, thanks, man.
Okay.
Take care.
Have a good day here.
How about Levon Helm?
Oh yeah,
great drummer.
Drummer
singing and playing drums.
I don't know how anybody can do that. I know there's many drummers that can't that do it, and I just it's yeah. beyond me. Having to focus on.
I agree. Drums. I agree. Yeah, I can. You know, I mean, I play drums, so but I can't sing. oh man, Ian Paice, Deep Purple. Yeah, Ian Paice is one of the best. You know, like sort of hard rock, heavy metal drummers of all time. He's like old school, man. He's got a lot of history. Got a lot of history. And, you know, does insane drum solos on those live albums, you know, like Made in Japan, Made in Europe. Yeah, Deep Purple, great band, and a really, really, really great drummer, Ian Paice. So, yeah, he's amazing to watch, that guy. And he's got some hair. He's got some hair, man.
It wouldn't be Deep Purple without the hair.
Yeah, he's got the hair and the mutton chops. The whole thing. Oh, man. Here's one of my favorites. Terry Bozzio from Missing Persons. That guy can play the drums, man. And he's very theatrical. Yeah, Terry Bozzio. He was amazing. He played with Zappa. His wife was nuts. Dale Bozzio. Great singer. But, yeah, no, he was... Terry Bozzio, like, really... really very theatrical drummer, and so much fun to watch. I love Missing Persons. I love that band. One of the most underrated bands of the 80s mm-hmm. is Missing Persons. Walking in L.A. God, such a great band.
I know there's a stereotype, but do you think that it's true that most drummers are kind of head cases?
Oh, yeah.
Like, just to be that kind of person.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you have to be a little bit crazy if you just want to slam the skins.
Absolutely.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, almost every really crazy story you hear about a band usually involves the drummer doing something physically dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're nuts. Most drummers are nuts. Yeah. So, all right, let's take a quick break here. I'll give you some weather, and then we'll come back. My dad will tell you a joke, and then we'll wrap up the show talking more drummers. Who are some of your favorite drummers? Who are some of the best drummers? And we're talking about this because Ginger Baker passed away over the weekend, and he was a great drummer and a great musician. And so that was that's got us on the subject here. 312-981-7200. Here's your forecast from WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, a picture perfect fall day, unlimited sunshine, nearly cloudless skies. Highs will reach in the middle to upper 60s, turning a little cooler in the afternoon. Lows will range from the middle 40s inland to the near 50 downtown. For tomorrow, another delightful fall day with abundant sunshine and light winds. Highs will approach 70 inland, but closer to 60 near the lake shore. For Wednesday, the fall weather trifecta brings another sunny and mild day, with highs peaking 5 degrees above seasonable normals. And for Thursday, still sunny. Clouds will increase, though. They could gather at night and for a chance of showers by daybreak. The high will reach in the low to mid-70s. And then for Friday, mostly cloudy, windy. Clusters of showers and gusty thunderstorms, high in the upper 60s, and it'll be turning colder late at night. It's currently 53 degrees at O'Hare. It's 54 at Midway, 56 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break. We come back. My dad's got a joke because it's a jokey time, and then we'll wrap up the show. Everybody hang on, and we shall return.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey time. It's a jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey time. It's a jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah, that's right. My dad tells a joke every Monday morning. We like to start off your work week with a laugh, so my dad calls in and tells a joke. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom coming up. All right, let's get my dad in here to tell a joke. Hey, Dad, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
All right, how's Ma?
Good.
Good. Okay, you got a joke.
Got one of my favorite drummers from the late 50s, early 60s, Cozy Cole.
Oh, sure.
The song Let There Be Drums.
Yeah, absolutely. Classic.
All right. My joke, an undertaker calls a man, says about your mother-in-law, should we embalm her, cremate her, or bury her? Man answers, do all three, we don't want to take any chances.
All right. Oh, man. All right, Dad, thanks, buddy.
All right, man, take care.
See you later. There's my dad. He will call in again next week.
That was jokey time. It was a jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next week. All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Wrapping up the show here. We're talking about drummers. Ginger Baker passed away, which is really sad, but we're still talking about some great drummers. How about Bill Bruford? Tremendous drummer from Yes and King Crimson. But really, one of those top notch drummers, man. Really, really good. Let's see. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Nick. How are you doing?
All right. What's up?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorites was already named Frank Said Max Roach, but I got a couple other drummers that I believe are top notch. Elvin Jones, Tony Williams, Art Blakey, and there's a local guy who's head of the jazz department at DePaul. Dana Hall, who's I've seen in various groups around town, and he's just fantastic.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Very, very cool. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks,
Nick. Take
Mike.
Care,
Take care, buddy. 312-981-7200. Benny Benjamin played on all the Motown stuff. He was one of those session guys. You know, one of those sort of, you know, we talk a lot about the, you know, session musicians, how they're kind of unsung heroes. You know, you don't know their names usually. But that's a guy that Benny Benjamin, just you'd be surprised just how many sort of classic tracks that that guy plays drums on. So, Alan Jackson Jr., legendary soul drummer with Stax. He was called the Human Timekeeper. That was his nickname.
I mean, when you're good, you're good.
He played on, like, Soul Man. He played on, Hold On, I'm Coming. Just, like, one of those guys, another one of these workman guys who played on so many classic cuts. Here's Tom on WGN. Hi, Tom.
How you doing, Nick?
All right, what's up?
I can't believe no one's mentioned Ringo.
Yeah, Ringo Starr.
I mean, listen to A Day in the Life. There's nothing better.
Yeah. No, he's a great drummer. And I don't think he gets the recognition he deserves.
And a lot of drummers say he was an influence. So
yeah, no question about it. All right, thanks, Tom.
Okay,
yeah,
bye.
Ringo Starr, man. Yeah, I don't think he gets the. I truly don't think that he gets the recognition that he deserves. You know. So, all right. How about Dennis Chambers? Also from Funkadelic. We mentioned Bill Bruford already. Buddy Rich comes in at number 15 on the list here. Ringo Starr comes in at number 14. So DJ Fontana, legendary, played on hundreds of Elvis recordings. And Charlie Watts, which we mentioned already, he comes in at number 12. Stuart Copeland comes in at the top 10. He's in number 10, which I believe is correct. Stuart Copeland is one of the best drummers alive, without question. Just a unique drummer with a really original style. And I've always loved him. I mean, the Police are one of my favorite bands of all time. They were my favorite band when I was in high school. Let's see. Here is Van on WGN. Hi, Van.
Good morning to everybody. How y'all doing?
All right. What's up?
Well, if I have to go with three, Maurice White, Earth, Wind & Fire, Diamond of the Ohio Players, and Jabbo Starks of James Brown.
Yeah, those guys are all great. And a lot of people don't realize what a good drummer Maurice White is. Everybody knows he can sing, you know?
Yeah.
But not a lot of people realize what a great drummer that guy is, what a incredible musician that guy.
Yes, sir, and he was bad on that Columbo.
He was, man. He was, absolutely. All right, Van, thanks, man.
All right, now. Have a good one.
You too. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here is Carl on WGN. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
I had two of them. Nico McBrien from Iron Maiden.
Oh,
and
sure.
And the Red Hot Chili Peppers drummer, Chet. Remember, they had that drum off on Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
With Will Ferrell.
With Will Ferrell, because he looks so much like him. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's them two, but my all-time favorite is Keith Moon.
Keith Moon, yep. Legendary. Absolutely legendary. All right, Carl, thanks.
All right, have a good day.
Yeah, Chad Smith from Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yeah, and he does look like he and Will Ferrell do look very, very close. Hal Blaine was played on the Ronettes. He played he was part of the Phil Spector's Wall of Sound, considered by many to be one of the greatest drummers of all time. That's Hal Blaine. And so Ginger Baker comes in at number 3 on the list, and we lost him over the weekend. Keith Moon at number 2, and then number 1, according to this Rolling Stones list, of course, is John Bonham. And I don't think a lot of people would argue that. If you're talking about rock guitarists or rock drummers, it doesn't get much better. It doesn't get much better than John Bonham. So, all right. Well, there you go. We got some stuff coming up on the show tomorrow. Tomorrow is Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. You're being 2 for Tuesday. Wait a minute. Hold on a second now. Hold on. What's going on here? Wait a minute. Why is this not working? Uh-oh. My echo is not working. Okay, we have to get the reverb fixed. Don't know what's going on, but we can't have a show without my reverb. So let's figure out what's going on there. Oh, wait. Hold on a second. Maybe it's this. Yeah. There it is. I got it.
Well, but a little behind the scenes there.
I got it. It's fixed. Hey, tomorrow's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday, so get your requests in tomorrow. It's one artist, two songs on your Tuesday. It is the anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire. So we're going to have a guest on to talk about the history of the Great Chicago Fire. And our good friend Kevin Powell, good old K-Powell, is going to talk to us about sports. We love to have Kevin on to chat about sports, and we'll do that tomorrow morning. So that's what's coming up on the Tuesday show. Kevin Powell talking sports. We're going to talk about the Great Chicago Fire, and we'll do some 2 for Tuesday right there. All right. So rest in peace to Ginger Baker, to Rip Taylor, and to Diane Carroll. We lost three pretty legendary entertainers over the weekend.
Isn't it weird, though, that it does really happen in threes?
And this definitely did.
Yeah. Very, very odd.
Yeah. Rip Taylor, man. I love Rip Taylor.
I think I'll have to go home and pop in Jackass the movie.
You're going to have to, yeah.
Just to go back.
I hope that, and like I said, I hope that like the Game Show Network and stuff does like a tribute to him.
I almost guarantee it.
Play a bunch of gong shows in a row. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening, and we're going to take a break here. The news is coming up, and then Steve Grzanich has the opening bell.